Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 25th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior correspondent at Vox.com, Ian Millhiser, will be here to talk about this week's Supreme Court nominee hearings and some of the rulings that we've seen from the Supreme Court. And, of course, Ginny Thomas. Also on the program today, Joe Biden meets with NATO and Europeans, plans to ease Europe's reliance on Russian fossil fuels. Meanwhile, Biden administration announces the U.S. will accept over 100,000 Ukrainian refugees. Domestically, U.S. weekly jobless claims dropped to the lowest level since 1969. President Manchin announces that he will vote for KBJ. So that drama is over. Meanwhile, at a clean coal conference, he announces he will sign on to a limited climate change bill. As long as there's deficit reduction. Yep. Also on the program today, Clarence Thomas's wife went full Q with the Donald Trump's chief of staff. Arizona passes a 15-week abortion ban. Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry found guilty of three campaign contribution felonies. Ethiopia declares a truce, at least for the moment, in Tigray. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. It is Casual Friday. And as I am when I am here, joined every day, Emma Vigeland.
Is Yoda talking?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, a little bit. We are way out of whack here on the...
You don't like the shot?
Looks a little weird. Wait,
should I go down?
You adjusted your camera down a little bit right before the show, so you go.
It's your fault.
Still not there. That still looks pretty weird. We'll work on that.
We've
had a little bit of... Yeah, but see, now I got no headroom.
Right, but just go up a little more.
There we go. Ladies and gentlemen,
a little bit more.
Emma and I did not call each other about what we were going to be wearing today.
Yeah, but we haven't done this in a while. All right, just...
There we go. Yep, all right. Friday, white day.
Don't say that.
What's that?
Yeah, that sounds bad.
Yeah, I guess so.
Actually, David Griscom and I had to change from, we were both wearing red hats.
MAGA day?
Yeah, I had to change.
It is a longstanding tradition for everyone on camera to wear white the day before our live show in Brooklyn, which is happening tomorrow. You can stream it, ladies and gentlemen, by going to amquickie.com. Ooh. They can't get the, can they get the break? If you sign up for AM Quickie, can you access it? You can't. They wouldn't get it until tomorrow. You got to go. You got to pay full price. I hope, did you mention that yesterday was the last day to do that? No.
I didn't. Sorry.
No. Go to Majority Live, click on the link, click through and see the live show happening tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. Check it out. You're not going to want to miss it. We've already seen the elements.
I saw a little bit of what is going to go down today, and it's pretty funny.
Well, we have a lot of stuff that's happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of crazy stuff.
Some news dropping.
Yeah. Whoa. Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't want to, I mean, I guess everybody's bought their tickets, but folks should check it out. Also, today's program brought to you by our favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeSabade.com. You can use the code LEFTISBEST. You get 20% off of everything. What do they have there? Only the best Sabade, maybe in the world.
It's so good.
It is. Listen, the bottom line is they have tinctures. They have tinctures in all sorts of concentrations. They have multiple flavors on their tinctures. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have keef. They have flowers and buds. They have CBD fudge. They have CBD. I mean, it makes a great gift. They have CBD gummies. Also actually makes a great gift.
Mm.
The tinctures also make a great gift. I've actually given the salve with Arnica and CBD in it. It's great for your muscles. If you're me, it's great for your eczema. If you're Dorsey, it's great for your beard. That's what they're going to come out next. That's what I say. They got to do that. But the thing about this company is their product has a tremendous amount of integrity. You know exactly what's in there. They break it down, a third party analysis of everything that's in their CBD, and like, the tincture has more CBD G than CBD A. Like that's just off the top of my head, but I've noticed that as we were going through it, you know. But you can see exactly what's in there. They have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They are movement partners. They've donated thousands of dollars to not just directly to charities, but to things like soup kitchens and labor strike funds. And they practice great agricultural practices. Work with the University of Vermont. They do regenerative farming. No use of pesticides. They use integrated pest management, organic fertilizer. It is, you cannot go wrong with this stuff. Check it out. You get 20% off. They chose the coupon code LEFTISBEST. Longtime listeners of this program, check it out. All right, let's get to this question is stunning. And you should understand this in the in light of the fact that over 50% of the country believe that Joe Biden has been not strong enough with Putin, God bless you.
Thank you.
And with Russia. And this is relevant. I mean, I personally, 56% of Americans say Biden, who's meeting on Thursday with European leaders, had not been tough enough in his response to what's going on in Russia. So he is going against the political tide in this country. We'll talk a little bit more about that because I know some people have some theories as to where that number came from. And we will get there. But I do believe that Joe Biden, up to this point, has deserved a tremendous amount of deserves a tremendous amount of credit for a measured, slow response to what is going on here. Like a very careful not to get the U.S. and involved in this in a way that would expand, or NATO for that matter, would expand the conflict. Here is, and look at the questions he's getting.
Right. And this is the pressure that is being put upon him to do something, do anything, even if the consequences could be World War III.
Yeah, but who would actually even phrase it like that?
What?
Cecilia, ABC. There you are. Oh.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Sir, you've made it very clear in this conflict that you do not want to see World War III. But is it possible that in expressing that so early that you were too quick to rule out direct military intervention in this war? Could Putin have been emboldened knowing that you are not going to get involved directly in this conflict?
No and no.
You do not believe that.
I mean, that's a pretty good answer.
Yeah. It treats it with the brevity it deserves.
Do you think that you were a little bit too rash in ruling out World War III? I mean, how twisted? How do you wake up in the morning and say, like, this is my question I'm going to...
But she was the most serious person in the room that day because she had the guts to weigh the consequences of World War III. I mean, you know.
And if Biden's measured response early was responsible for actually causing the conflict to get worse, like,
yeah,
insane.
Right. You know, it's just insane. And,
this is a strength versus your weakness.
And again, that pressure that he's getting from the press, it may be coming from other quarters in the United States, although I haven't seen too much of it. There you get a little bit, but it's usually like, you know, op-ed writers, columnists who are just like, is this a take that's going to get me some clicks? 56% of Americans said Biden has not been tough enough. Now, there's a couple theories out there in the sort of dumb campist world, as it were, the would-be anti-imperialists, except for with an asterisk. Maybe that's what we should call them, asterisk anti-imperialists, who believe that this is a proxy war that is being waged. There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, it's quite obvious. I mean, everybody's been very explicit about it. The West is providing military aid to Ukraine upon their request. It would be pretty stunning if they didn't, if we were just going to just watch Ukraine get decimated without making any effort whatsoever. The other thing you would believe would be that the all of the accusations about Donald Trump's relationship with Russia, all of the accusations separately of Russian interference as a weird way, trying to influence our election in 2016. They may have done it in 2020. They may have done it for Biden, and who knows? But certainly in 2016, we know that because of those narratives, it created a bloodlust amongst Americans, particularly the Democrats, to go after Russia. And so when you see something like this, 56% of Americans think that Biden has not been tough enough. It really does make you think maybe that was the case, except for then you read the next line in, you realize it's 68% of Republicans say that Joe Biden's not been tough enough. 68% of Republicans want war with Russia. Because honestly, like, what more can Biden do at this point that doesn't creep up to that line?
But at the same time, I doubt that they want war with Russia. They're just partisan, and so they perceive Biden as being weak. That's the party line, and they're going to say that regardless.
But the point, of course,
but Republican politicians also are the ones that are going out there and saying, we need to consider military action. We're essentially already at war. That's what Senator Kennedy said last week. So, you know,
if Biden had started it, they would be going like, he's done too much.
But Biden's the leader of the Democratic Party.
Right,
and
right.
Biden is not putting boots on the ground or doing a no-fly zone or escalating this. He is trying very hard not to do so.
43% of Democrats want Biden to be tougher. Now, take from that what you will. But the bottom line is all of these narratives that we've been fed about Russiagate causing this. And, you know, and I am certainly critical of NATO expansion, have been. But the idea that Russia is now saying, like, you know, the West has essentially declared war on Russia by arming the country that is fighting Russia in their country. There's an easy way to end this conflict. That is, get out. Stop. And, you know, at one point, it's going to be, Ukraine seems to be on the offensive in certain areas. But it really is a grave miscalculation, it appears, by Putin. And we're almost seeing like the reverse of like the 2016 election. Putin's looking around. Pretty soon it's going to be Hillary Clinton's fault that he invaded. But there we are. We got to take a break. Do we need to take a break or no? We don't need to. Okay. So we had a little technical difficulties. We pre-taped this interview with Ian Millhiser about an hour ago.
You will see Sam sitting in my seat.
I sat in Emma's seat because we could not get things going on this thing. So Emma's just off on the side telling me what questions.
No complaints about the panels for Sam. I mean, I know that that's going to throw people off because they got the white panels behind you.
Yep.
Right?
Well, it's Friday. Well, day before the.
No. Thank you.
All right. Good. Let's just go to a quick break, and then we come right back. We'll be talking to Ian Millhiser. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining me now, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program senior correspondent from Vox, Ian Millhiser. Ian, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much, Sam.
I have an idea. I know what you've been doing the past week in terms of watching the hearings. Let's start there. I've got a lot of stuff I want to ask you about KBJ as a jurist, and then some of the things that are happening with the Supreme Court. Your take on what we saw this week. And in fact, I think just like literally an hour ago, Joe Manchin said that he's going to be voting for KBJ. So it seems to be essentially a fait accompli at this point. But your sense of the hearing.
Yeah. So I think the biggest story that emerged from this hearing is that QAnon is now a major force within the Republican Party, and it, you know, is going to be a faction that Republican presidential contenders are going to openly appeal to. So QAnon, for those who are not familiar, is this elaborate conspiracy that believes a lot of crazy things. But one of the crazy things that they believe is that there is a cabal of pedophiles that may or may not be running the country, and that is often associated with high profile Democrats. And so you had Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, throwing around very spurious accusations that Ketanji Brown Jackson is soft on child pornographers.
And we should say, this sort of era started off in many respects with Pizzagate. Right. But there has been a long-term fixation by the right with pedophilia that, academics have argued was a function which started in the 80s with the scares about daycare centers, and was really a function of the sort of, I guess, some weird reaction to the what we called the women's liberation movement back then, as women left the home to go and get jobs and had to, their kids got daycare. This was all sort of part of that, and it has sort of metastasized into this Q thing. So where does that leave us? I mean, in terms of they knew Hawley was going to do this. Does Hawley need permission when he goes in there to do this? Or is it just one of those things where Mitch McConnell's like, oy, well, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, when you're a senator, they let you do it. You know, it's kind of like when you're a star, I guess. There's no real way to rein in someone like Josh Hawley, who just wants to talk a lot about child pornography. He's a senator, we can't stop the fact that the people of Missouri elected him. He's allowed to be in that committee hearing and talk about child pornography all he wants. But I mean, I will say that this like sort of obsession with like sexual danger for children has been an off again, on again feature of social conservative politics for a really long time. I mean, I think about Anita Bryant. I think back in the 70s, who was an anti-gay crusader. And one of her big crusades was to ban gay people from being school teachers, because the idea was that if you were gay and you were in charge of children, then obviously you must want to have sex with them or something. And the, you know, we're seeing a revival of this, not just in what Josh Hawley is doing, but, you know, if you look at the rhetoric from Governor Ron DeSantis's office in Florida around the Don't Say Gay bill, like the word grooming was being thrown around a lot, as if, you know, going back to Anita Bryant, as if you have a gay teacher, somehow this gay teacher is endangering children, as if the mere discussion of LGBT issues in a classroom is somehow preparing children to be preyed upon sexually. So like, this has been a feature of social conservative politics, and it's like, you know, sometimes they turn the dimmer up, sometimes they turn the dimmer down. It's not always front and center in those politics, but it's having a resurgence. And I think that that explains why Josh Hawley thought he could score political points by talking so much about child pornography.
And one of the reasons why I think it's having a resurgence, and I should say that I think that, you know, the only difference I think between now and then is maybe just the sheer number of people who subscribe to this sort of like fear that gay people are going to groom their kids. I think it's just like a smaller number than it was maybe, you know, during Anita Bryant's time. Or, you know, and it may has changed. The dynamic may have changed because those Christian conservatives are more involved in our politics than they were, I think, at that time as well. But the bottom line is that social conservatives now know they have a Supreme Court that is amenable to these things. And so it is churning the waters, right? I mean, it's not like people's attitudes have changed as much as the Supreme Court now is no longer hostile to these type of things, I guess, right? I mean, we're starting to see that, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, I think the broader context here is like, basically, because our Senate is so broken, the Supreme Court no longer resembles like the American people as a whole. So when Barack Obama nominated Merrick Garland in 2016, the block of Democratic senators represented something like 20 million more people than the block of Republican senators, even though there were 55 Republicans and 45 Democrats. And the reason why is because the Senate is malapportioned. You know, Wyoming has approximately two people in it. They both get to be senators. California has almost 40 million people in it. Only two of those people get to be senators. And so, you know, I think Daily Kos actually crunched the numbers on this, and they found that Republicans haven't legitimately won a Senate majority since the late 90s. Like, a majority of the country hasn't voted for Republican senators since, I think, 1998.
Wow.
And so that, because the Senate confirms justices, that means Barack Obama couldn't get Merrick Garland confirmed. Every single one of Donald Trump's three Supreme Court appointments were nominated by a president who lost the popular vote and confirmed by a block of senators who represent less than half the country. So you have this rump anti-gay majority that, you know, wants to pass a Don't Say Gay bill in Florida, that, you know, thinks it can score political points like Josh Hawley did talking about child pornography. It's a small minority of the country, but it controls five or six votes on the Supreme Court because, you know, our system is not set up democratically.
And just to add to that, put a little cherry on top of it, I think five of our Supreme Court justices that are on the court right now were ultimately confirmed by presidents who did not win the majority of the vote either. So, Donald Trump did not win the majority of the vote. Three of those people, there's two, from the George Bush era as well.
He also did not win the majority of the vote in that first 4 years. But at the end of the day, in terms of the hearings, if Joe Manchin has declared that he's going to vote, the rest is, as they say, commentary, right? I mean, it really is just a reflection. Let me ask you this with that in mind, because I don't know if this is, you consider this your project, but you, we have spoken in the past, you have written about this, about your sense that the Supreme Court is highly problematic. Yes. for these reasons that we have discussed, and just as an institution in and of itself. How much does this go towards, like, how much do, when we see with, like, with Hawley doing this type of thing, and the Republicans is sort of at large doing this, is this going to help get people who are center left through the left on some levels, pay more attention to what's going on with the Supreme Court and get more engaged in the implications of this court? I mean, it's still, we're looking at maybe a 10, 15, 20 year project in terms of, yeah, like getting the Supreme Court back in some fashion, but it's got to start at one point, and it still feels like there's not an appreciation of just, yeah, how twisted things are on that court and how nasty things are about to come because of what they're going to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, one piece of good news for people who think that the court is out of whack right now is that the polls are showing Democrats waking up. I think Pew just had a poll come out recently which showed that more Democratic voters think of the Supreme Court as an important issue than Republicans now. And that's consistent with polls from the 2020 election, which showed that more Democrats were engaged with the Supreme Court as an issue than Republicans. And that's a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, I think we really saw that shift around the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation, because, you know, when you have a justice who is very credibly accused of trying to rape someone, Democratic voters don't like that very much. And so you're starting to see Democratic voters wake up. I think, you know, I think it is very likely that Roe v. Wade is going to be overruled in June. You know, there's a number of very scary election cases coming. I think the Supreme Court is going to dismantle most of America's gun laws this term. There's just a lot. I mean, we've already seen the court giving big legal exemptions to the Christian right. So there's a lot of scary stuff happening in the Supreme Court. And I think that if America functions as a democracy, you know, if we have free and fair elections, if the Supreme Court does not do some of the things it's considering, like, you know, allowing state legislatures to overturn presidential elections and stuff like that, then, like, you know, I think that the wind is in the Democratic sails right now. Democratic voters have really woken up to this. But the problem is that when you control the Supreme Court, you control the shape of our democracy. Right. And even if the Supreme Court is completely honest and doesn't, like, do anything more to dismantle the voting, I mean, there's a bad Voting Rights Act decision this week. But, you know, even if they don't do anything more to dismantle the Voting Rights Act, I think Democrats still have to contend with the fact that the Electoral College is rigged against them. The Senate is malapportioned against them. And that means that Democrats consistently need to win elections by 3, 4, 5 points just to achieve, you know, rough equality with the Republican Party.
OK, so let's turn to Ketanji Brown Jackson. Give me your sense of how you think she is going to fit in on this court, and keeping in mind forefronted that she very well may serve the vast majority of her term being in the minority of justices. So, like, what, generically speaking, if that's the case versus one being on the majority side, Do you need to be a different justice,
yeah,
for that moment? And what should that be if, for those of us who are, you know, want the court to be as left as possible? And, you know, I don't know that the three liberal justices are necessarily that left, but they're certainly more left than the other six on the court.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could speak to how Ketanji Brown Jackson has behaved as a lower court judge, which is, I mean, she has a reputation for writing very, very long opinions. things. And she is especially likely to write like 100-page or more opinions in the most politically charged cases, you know, cases where, you know, about whether Donald Trump can be forced to testify or Donald Trump's advisors can be forced to testify or not, cases about whether a Trump program is lawful or not. And this is true. I mean, sometimes she ruled in favor of Trump, sometimes she ruled against Trump, but those opinions tend to be very, very long. And I think the reason why she took that approach is because she knew her decisions would ultimately be appealed to a very hostile Supreme Court. And so she knew that she couldn't cut corners, that she had to show that every part of her reasoning was airtight. She had to walk people through it. You know, she had to assume that the people reading her opinions were adults and wanted to know what was going on. And then, you know, I mean, I see the opposite. Like when I cover the Fifth Circuit, which is this extraordinarily partisan conservative court that oversees Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi, often you get these really short clipped opinions that declare things without much justification. And, you know, when you have a Supreme Court majority, you can get away with that because, you know, they just have to like the outcome. You know, it doesn't right. matter if you've got good reasoning. I think Ketanji Brown Jackson knows that when you are swimming upstream against a right-wing court, you have to make sure all your T's are crossed and all your I's are dotted. And I suspect that that's what we're going to see from her as a dissenting justice, is, you know, just believing that through sheer force of the effort of making the most comprehensive possible case, she can maybe shame her colleagues into behaving sensibly.
Is there a value to those extended dissents, which I think is safe to assume that they're going to be, does the value lie solely in the moment of trying to convince those other justices, or is there a value for essentially planting seeds for a different balanced court down the road in which to, like, Do you follow my what I'm? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Will you expand on that and explain how that process takes hold? Like, yeah. How can Justice, you know, whoever it is, 20 years from now, the fifth sort of left leaning justice on the court, you know, it's Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett, and maybe, you know, I don't know who else has hung on, Alito at that point. And there's five now, liberal justices. How do they look back on some of those briefs to reverse the stuff that we're going to see over the next 10, 15 years?
So oddly enough, I think the smartest strategist on this point is Justice Scalia, the conservative icon. You know, Scalia used to always write these really pugnacious opinions, you know, had really grabby language in it. And he was very open about why he did that. He said, look, I am not going to change my colleagues' minds. You know, I'm not going to change the current generation's minds. But if you go to law school, like the way that law school works is every textbook, they're called case books. And the reason why is because the way that the law is taught is you read Supreme Court opinions and you read the majority opinion and you read the dissenting opinion. And then, you know, you have a discussion in class with the professor about like what points the majority thought was important, what points the dissent was important, and so on and so forth. And Scalia's theory is, look, I can write these really punchy dissents. All these law students are going to read them. And in 20 years, they're going to be running the damn country. And if I can convince them, then I win 20 years down the road. And so that is a path that is available to Ketanji Brown Jackson or to any other justice on the Supreme Court. I think the problem with that path is, I mean, I do not believe in the idea that, like, I think the Federalist Society is very fond of, that Scalia just made such a great case for originalism and originalism is so persuasive that now, no, the reason why Republicans control the Supreme Court and the reason why originalism is having a moment is because the Electoral College gave the White House to Donald Trump, even though Hillary Clinton won the 2016 election. It's because malapportionment gave the Senate to Republicans, even though Democrats received more votes. And so you know, in the alternative universe where we had fair elections in the United States, we would probably have like a 6-3 Democratic majority on the Supreme Court. So
this would all be academic.
But assuming that we can solve our electoral problems, then like the path for a dissenting justice is to think about, you know, I'm not going to persuade Neil Gorsuch to be sensible, but I might persuade the person who's going to be appointed to the Supreme Court in 20 years.
That's interesting. And we should say that that potential person is going to respond to a different type of dissent than maybe the one that was open to the idea that, you know, like Scalia said, you know, that racism is essentially over. it doesn't make sense for if Ketanji Brown Jackson, we don't know that she does, but if she did have that desire to speak to a Supreme Court justice who's not even probably born yet, or maybe is just entering into law school, you know, in this year or something, it's not going to be the same, you know, type of language, I guess, that Scalia would use, because she's looking, that person's going to be more like her than it will be more like Scalia, I guess, right, in terms of who that will be. All right. So, and do you get the sense that, I mean, based upon your reading of what she would write as an appellate judge, that she would, that she's suited to that task? Are there other, you know, between Sotomayor and Kagan, are they also suited towards that task? Do you think that they have that sensibility or that sense of that's what they're doing?
So I think that Sotomayor and Kagan have different strategies in their dissent, and they're very complementary of each other. So Justice Kagan I think she's probably the smartest justice. She's brilliant. She's very technocratic in her approach, and she's very good at using the other side's rhetoric against it, or against itself. Like she is probably the most, you know, Gorsuch loves to talk about textualism, and then he'll happily ignore the text of a statute when he wants a particular result. Justice Kagan is actually a really committed textualist. And she's really, you know, there was a Voting Rights Act case recently, for example, where, you know, Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion and he just made a bunch of crap up. Like, you know, he said that, like, any voting restriction that was commonplace in 1982 is presumptively lawful. Where does that rule come from? It's sure as hell not in the statute. And right. Justice Kagan wrote a brilliant dissent where she said that Alito's opinion mostly occupies a law-free zone. And just in a very crisp, I mean, like, it was rhetorically very profound about the importance of the Voting Rights Act, but the meat of that opinion was just a very crisp, technocratic, no, this is what the text of the law says. This is how judges are supposed to behave. And like, as a lawyer, I am going to tell you what the statute actually says. Sotomayor, I think, tends to have more aspirational dissents, you know, especially in the criminal justice context. You know, the interesting thing about Sotomayor is that she's one of, I think, two justices who are former prosecutors, but she's the only justice who is a state level prosecutor, which means that she had to work a lot with cops. And I think the lesson that she got out of that is she knows every trick that the cops pull. And now she calls them out on it in her opinions. You know, Sotomayor, I think, you know, while Kagan is like looking at today's battle and saying, like, here is what should have happened today, Sotomayor, I think, is trying to articulate, you know, a broader vision and, like, you know, be more aspirational, give liberals something more to aspire to. I don't know. I mean, you know, being a justice is different than being a judge, because when you're a justice, like, there aren't constraints on you. You only have to follow precedent when you feel like it. You hear the most difficult cases. You hear the most politically charged cases. And so, like, I don't know if KBJ is going to wind up being more like Kagan or more like Sotomayor. I don't know if she's going to find a different path. But like, one thing that, you know, because I think Kagan and Sotomayor have both charted like very different and very complementary paths in their dissent, I think that would give, you know, hopefully Justice Jackson a fair amount of leeway to figure out, like, okay, what is my role to play right. here in this project, given that these other roles are already being fulfilled?
Okay, so with that said, let's turn to some of these cases that have happened recently or at the Supreme Court. I also want to just check in with you about Ginni Thomas, because I think that story is just unbelievable, just insane. But
although I have to say one thing about Ginni Thomas, like, if you think her texts are bad, wait till I tell you about how in 2000 Clarence Thomas conspired with four other high-ranking government officials to overturn a presidential election. It was a huge scandal.
Right. No, yes. And believe me, it was an obsession of mine. But we'll get to that in a moment, because that is a crazy story, but one which I think I want to get your take on, and you've written about this in terms of Wisconsin. This is another assault on the Voting Rights Act. Yeah. And the court has been, it's getting just nakeder and nakeder, it feels like, yeah, in terms of the way that they're dealing with this. But tell us about Wisconsin first.
Yeah. So, I mean, everything about this Wisconsin story is gross. So Wisconsin for the last 10 years has not had Democratic elections. Like the Wisconsin State Assembly, the Wisconsin State Legislature is so gerrymandered that it was basically impossible for Democrats to win. I think
52, the Democrats win something like 52% of the vote in the last election, and they have 35 out of 100 representatives. So yes, 52% of the vote ends up providing them 33 or 35% of the representation. It's just, it's insane. It's nuts.
It's bonkers. So yeah. So the first thing that the Wisconsin Supreme Court does, which has a 4-3 Republican majority on it, is it says that so the governor and the legislature deadlock on what the new map should look like. The state Supreme Court says, well, whatever the new maps are, we want maps that most closely resemble the old maps. So they're already trying to lock in these maps that favor Republicans. And then they say to the governor and the state legislature, propose some maps to us and we'll pick the one that's most similar. And Tony Evers, the Democratic governor, sort of grits his teeth and says, well, okay, that's what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to try to make the best of it. And he tries to draw the best map that he can within these very Republican favorable constraints. And it gets up to the state Supreme Court again. And Justice Brian Hagedorn, I think is how he pronounces his name, is kind of like the John Roberts of Wisconsin. Like, he's a very, very conservative judge, but he sometimes crosses over and votes with the liberals. And he does that here. He says, like, well, under the standard that we announced, make it as similar as possible to the old maps. Tony Evers, the Democratic governor's maps win. So we are going to adopt the Democratic governor's maps. The thing about those maps is that, so the old maps had 6 majority black districts. Evers's maps had 7 majority black districts. And this goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, it's a very confusing decision, but basically what they say is, before you're allowed to draw an extra majority black district, you have to first show that you considered all the other alternatives that only had 6 majority black districts to make sure that, like, those aren't going to, it's very unclear what you're supposed to do, but, like, basically placed a presumption that, like, you should keep it to 6, and, like, only if you can't achieve the goals of the Voting Rights Act or whatever with 6 are you then allowed to have 7. Now, I mean, I've read the Constitution, I've read the Voting Rights Act, and I'm pretty sure that the 14th Amendment was not enacted to diminish the power of African-American voters. You know, it wasn't enacted to prevent states from giving slightly more political power to black people. You know, I'm pretty sure that's not what this is about, but that's what the Supreme Court said. And so, I mean, it was, again, like, I apologize that I'm not being articulate in describing this decision. It was a very brief decision. It was a very poorly reasoned decision. And so I'm not entirely clear what the legal rule is going to emerge from this very confusing, like, I think it was maybe an 8-page opinion that the court released. But it's clear that the justices are thinking, you know, we are skeptical of any project that sets out to have more majority black districts in a state.
There's a couple of like sort of subsidiary issues here. One is the fact that it was only 8 pages long. Like the way, the methodology in which they're now beginning to approach these things is similar to the way you describe the Fifth Circuit, which is like, we don't really have to provide much reasoning for this stuff at the end of the day. Cause we've got, now that we have six of us, you know, it almost feels like the reasoning was usually to get, like, you know, we needed to get Anthony, you know, we needed to get Kennedy on board, or we needed to get like that fifth vote. Those five votes are locked in now. It seems like virtually any project, unless there's some idiosyncratic, you know, thing that like, Clarence Thomas is like, well, you know, back in old times, people had a flair on their, you know, their fonts. And so that's what, you know, something like that. But, so, I mean, talk about this move to now essentially say, like, we don't really need to give you a reason, which is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, this arose on the shadow docket, which is like a process that used to just involve like most of the emergency orders. Like the origins of the shadow docket actually came out of the death penalty, because like you had a state that's going to execute someone at midnight tonight, and the court can't like it normally does in ordinary cases, just be like, okay, well, we're going to ask for a bunch of briefing and then spend a few months thinking about this case, because the person will be dead if you spend a few, you know. But now they've been using the shadow docket over and over again to decide really important precedential cases, like what does the Voting Rights Act mean, you know, in a few days. And like, that in and of itself is very problematic, because the Supreme Court has the last word. Like, the reason why the way that the court has always functioned in these big cases is it gets hundreds of pages of briefs. It reads it all. They spend months thinking about it, is because when you are the gods of law, like when no one can stop you, like at the least we could expect from like our supreme overlords is that they spend a few months thinking about what they're doing before they do it. They're not doing that anymore in every case.
I think this is also an important, like, it's important for, you know, posterity and for the future, for people to sort of like reassess these things. But it's also, you know, in a very sort of like intangible way, it is, you know, you talk about training people to accept, like, you know, authoritarian measures. When the court doesn't feel like it even owes an explanation, right? Like, that's what it comes down to. The court does not feel like it owes the American public an explanation as to why they're making these rulings, particularly ones that are, you know, they're not uncontroversial. They're not just going with the flow. They're changing things dramatically. And when they essentially say to the American public, we don't owe you an explanation on this, it becomes even that much more. You're taking something that's already undemocratic and you're making it really, really sort of like, very like a vibrant authoritarianism.
And the other thing is, like, they aren't even explaining why they aren't being consistent with themselves. So like in early February, there was another gerrymandering case out of Alabama. Lower court had thrown out Alabama's map, said they were a racial gerrymander because like basically they didn't have enough majority black districts to account for the large minority of black voters in the state. And the Supreme Court tossed it out. The Supreme Court tossed out the lower court decision, reinstated the Republican Party's racially gerrymandered maps. The full court didn't explain itself. But Brett Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, wrote an opinion that was joined by Samuel Alito. And he said, okay, the reason why I think that we need to toss out the lower court's opinion is we're too close to an election. And courts shouldn't be messing around with state election laws when we're too close to an election. Now, first of all, that opinion was written in early February. The election is in November. So 8 months is too close to an election. Like, you know, what do you mean? Like, or, you know, does that mean that courts aren't allowed to decide election cases at all in election years? Like, that just seems like a really long window to say we're too close to an election.
Right. In times in the past, they've said they've looked at the facts, like the ballots have already been printed or, you know, like machines have already been set up in districts or something like this. There didn't seem to be any physical constraints. There was like a sort of random temporal one that seemed completely unassociated with the facts on the ground.
Right. Yeah. So like the rule that if you're too close to an election, court shouldn't muck around with the state's election law has been around since 2006. But like you said, like in the past, it would come up in cases like, you know, exactly. Like the ballots have already been printed. Many voters have already cast their vote. And if a court steps in and says, oh, wait, you got to change the ballot, that like you just can't run an election under those terms. That's not what happened here. Again, like the election is in November. So now we have this new case out of Wisconsin. So the first case, the Alabama case, the lower court's decision benefited the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party wanted these maps struck down. The Republican Party wanted them upheld. Now it's, you know, we have this decision out of Wisconsin. It is now late March. So we are now even closer to the election than we were when this Alabama case came down. You know, the biggest difference in this case is now the party's positions are flipped. The Democratic Party wants to keep the maps and the Republican Party wants the maps tossed out. And here we are, you know, almost 2 months closer to the election and the Supreme Court tosses out the maps. And I mean, there was one line in the majority opinion saying we're doing this now and we're doing it very quickly because we want to give the state enough time to figure out what maps it's going to use. But like, I think that Brett Kavanaugh owed us an explanation. I think that Samuel Alito owed us an explanation because like, if you're going to say in February that it's too close to the election for the courts to step in, then you need to explain yourself. When you turn around, you know, 6-7 weeks later and say, oh, now it's not too close to the election.
And particularly, it seems like there's going to be a much bigger process involved in Wisconsin than the process had already been done in Alabama on some level. Right. Or, I mean, at least there was an understanding. I guess it gets to that original point that they are now sort of moving into a post-reasoning phase of the Supreme Court where it's just simply, we're just going to decide now.
Yeah. And I mean, I want to be like, maybe there is an explanation. I mean, like the primary dates are different in the two states. Like, you know, maybe there is some plausible but like setting aside the politics of this, like if I were a justice, I would want people to understand what I'm doing because, you know, when you're a judge, you aren't elected. Like your legitimacy does not flow from the will of the people. Like members of Congress can do whatever the hell they want. And the reason they can do whatever the hell they want is that their legitimacy stems from the fact that the people chose them to exercise discretion. Judges' power flows from the fact that they are obedient to a legal text. There are rules. They are written down. Judges have to follow them. And if you aren't explaining what you're doing, eventually, like, that delegitimizes your institution. You know, that causes people like me to come on your radio show and say, I don't know what the court is doing here, but it sure doesn't look like law. And so, again, maybe Brett Kavanaugh has an explanation for why these two votes don't seem to be able to be squared. You know, maybe Sam Alito, it is in their interest to explain themselves. Because, you know, if they have a good explanation, then I look like an asshole. Right. Like, you know, if they have an explanation for it, they can shut down their critics, but they are acting like they don't have to worry about criticism. They don't have to worry about their legitimacy. They don't have to worry about how they look. And, you know, they're not even going to bother to explain things that, you know, that don't on their face make any sense.
It's either arrogance or maybe they realize like, we don't necessarily have a great argument in this situation. And so it just feels like it's not that close now in March when it felt like in February it was super close.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with abortion. You've just said earlier that you think Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned in June via this Tennessee case, which essentially bans abortion after 15 weeks and thereby, you know, shattering the Roe v. Wade standard. But let's talk about what's happening in Texas.
Yeah.
Because the Supreme Court essentially, as far as I can tell, sort of has, you know, like a passive voice, I guess, said it's okay to abridge a constitutional right. Abortion still remains a constitutional right. It is okay to abridge a constitutional right if it is only the state empowering the civil procedure, civil courts to do it. I mean, that's right. I mean, that characterization is correct, isn't it? It's basically saying like the as long as the state's not doing it directly, as long as they're just simply setting up a law that, you know, where you can get sued to oblivion if you, perform an abortion or help with an abortion or, you know, locate it around an abortion. And now we're seeing this in Tennessee. We're seeing it in Idaho. I imagine, I think there's one or two other states, maybe Kentucky. Is this going to open up an entirely new sort of like way of abridging rights in the Constitution or just in general?
Yeah. No, what happened with Texas and SB 8 is very frightening. So first of all, I mean, the Supreme Court hasn't yet written the rules. Roe v. Wade is overruled. But like Roe v. Wade is effectively dead right now. Like a state could ban all abortions right now if it wanted to. So what happened in this case, it's called Whole Women's Health v. Jackson, is so Texas wrote a law which said, like, we're banning all abortions after 6 weeks, but no one in the state government is allowed to enforce this law. Instead, we're appointing literally every person in the world as a bounty hunter. Like, you know, someone in Nigeria could sue if they want to under this Texas law. And what the law says that if you suspect someone of performing an abortion before 6 weeks, you can sue them. If you win, if you prove that they performed an abortion, then you get a $10,000 or a bounty of at least $10,000. And the at least is important. I mean, a court could say, okay, we're going to give you $1 million bounty or $1 billion. There's no upper limit on the
from
bounty.
The person they sue.
So exactly.
It's not like a government sponsored bounty. It is like, it's an award essentially from the other, from the defendant. Okay.
Yeah. So like if I'm suspected of performing an abortion that violates SBA, someone sues me and if they win, I have to pay the bounty. And the problem with this stat is first of all, like there's no upper limit on the bounty. Second of all, there's no limit on how many people can sue. So if you're suspected of performing an abortion, you might be sued in, you know, 20,000 people might sue you, hoping that they're going to get to collect the bounty. And the sheer, like, hiring enough lawyers to defend against 20,000 lawsuits, like, that's going to bankrupt you, regardless of whether or not you win them. Like, you know, like, you could win every single one of them. It doesn't matter because you can't afford to litigate all these cases. So the fear of just having to be being hauled into court and having all these legal fees has terrorized Texas abortion clinics into compliance with this unconstitutional law because they are afraid that if they do not comply with it, then like, you know, then they're done. Then all their money has to go to the lawyers. So that's the theory behind this. And what the Supreme Court said in Whole Woman's Health v. Jackson is basically that's fine. What they said is that if a state uses this kind of bounty hunter structure, you're not allowed to go to federal court and sue to get a court order blocking the law in its entirety. The only thing you're allowed to do is wait until you're sued, And then after you are sued, you can then, in the court that you were sued in, raise the defense. Well, I think this lawsuit shouldn't go forward because the law is unconstitutional. But again, even if you win on that argument, even if all the states agree with, all state courts agree with you that the law is unconstitutional, you could still be hit with 20,000 lawsuits, have to hire an army of lawyers, and then you have to shut down your clinic because all of your money has gone to legal fees.
If I was to say, like, okay, I'm a billionaire and I'm going to buy this clinic and I'm going to test this law and I'm going to fend off all these things and I'll have these lawyers and I win in one of those cases. In other words, I defend myself.
Yes.
Does that then provide the opportunity for the Supreme Court to address this methodology? Or is it just like you just happen to win in that case?
Yeah. I mean, well, the Supreme Court could, you know, that it, what would potentially happen is that, you know, you get sued in the state court, you litigate, it gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Theoretically, like, I mean, it's not going to happen because the U.S. Supreme Court is probably going to overrule Roe v. Wade. But theoretically, the U.S. Supreme Court could then strike the law down. But so what? You know, you're still going to, you could still be sued again under the law. If you have a U.S. Supreme Court opinion saying that the law is unconstitutional, you can raise that as a defense. So, like, after
in the state court, but it doesn't eliminate, it doesn't, they haven't found that the law is unconstitutional, just the product of the law.
Exactly. Yeah. The law is still on the books. So people will still be able to sue you under that law. You're still going to have to pay to hire a lawyer. And that lawyer will then file a brief. Yeah.
I'm just so like, don't they perceive like this could be, we've opened up a Pandora's box here, like, because it's not going to stop with abortion.
Yes.
I mean, why would it? I mean, why couldn't I do this with the First Amendment? Why couldn't I do? I mean, because if you don't have to even prove any damages, right? I mean, what are the damages that I, Sam Cedar, have? If a woman in Texas gets an abortion, like what is the, there's no possible damage there. How do I get an award for that? So, I mean, this seems to be just chaos.
Yeah. And I mean, what it really surprised me that the decision came down the way it did at the U.S. Supreme Court, because there was a brief filed by a bunch of gun groups. And what they said was like, look, like if you let this law stand, California is actually already considering a law like this. Some blue state is going to pass a law saying that anyone who owns a gun can be sued by a bounty hunter. And like every gun owner is suddenly going to be in danger of having these bounty hunters come after them. And like, yeah, you can't run a country that way. I mean, what happens if Florida decides to pass a law saying that anyone who criticizes Governor DeSantis can be sued by some bounty hunter? Like, there has to be a way to stop that, or you don't have a constitution.
I mean, I don't want my kids to be taught by a straight person. And like, you know, like, I mean, like, it doesn't, if there's no sort of damages associated with this, if there's no, I mean, that's the other part of the, you know, aside from it being an end run around, a way to avoid the federal courts, it also seems to be like setting a new structure for tort actions.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's no damages here. I don't understand how this is. The $10,000 is completely, and like you say, it can go upwards, but I mean, it's a completely random number. It seems just that they have blessed slap suits, which were just lawsuits as a way of like, if I have more resources, I go after you. And just to change your behavior in some way.
Yeah. I mean, what bothers me is that the court is letting the policy outcome that they want drive the ship here. Like, if the court, like, I get it. They hate Roe v. Wade. They hate abortion. There is a procedurally proper way to overrule Roe v. Wade. There's a procedurally proper way to do it quickly. Like, what they could have done in the Texas SB 8 case is instead of make up this loophole that essentially swallows up the entire Constitution, they could have said, okay, here's what we're going to do. we are ordering the parties to brief the question of whether or not Roe v. Wade should be overruled.
Right.
We're going to decide this case on an expedited basis. And then 3 days later, we're going to release an opinion saying, yes, Roe v. Wade is overruled. Now, I wouldn't have liked that outcome. Like, I think that would be bad because I support abortion rights. But that is procedurally normal. Like, the Supreme Court is allowed to take briefing on whether to overrule an opinion. It's allowed to overrule its own opinions. It would not threaten to swallow up literally every other constitutional right. And it doesn't put the justices in this untenable position. Like, someone is going to pass that you could sue any gun owner law eventually.
Right. I hope so.
And there's no way the Supreme Court's going to let that law stand. Like right. They will come up with some reason to strike that law down. And again, like, why do you make yourself look like?
It feels like they are just trying to create facts on the ground and that make it a fait accompli on some level that they're going to repeal. Like you said, effectively speaking, Roe v. Wade is dead. And that's sort of like the effective part of it. It's effectively dead. Allows them to sort of like lead from behind. Then they can go back in and clean that stuff up if they want, because it becomes no longer necessary to have those civil procedures. All right. Lastly, I know you got to get going. We got to get going. Take a minute or two to talk about Ginni Thomas.
Oh, man. I mean, here's the thing about Ginni Thomas. So Ginni Thomas wrote a bunch of like comically overwritten texts. I think part of the scandal here is like, is this woman capable of writing at any tone that doesn't sound like a Trump fundraising email? But setting that aside, like, she was encouraging senior White House officials, including the chief of staff, to, you know, try to overturn the 2020 election. And I guess what I have to say about that is, like, if you think that's bad, wait till you see what her husband's been doing in his legal opinions. Like, right. I mean, and it's not just Bush v. Gore. I mean, like, Clarence Thomas wrote in a concurring opinion, a case called U.S. v. Lopez. He embraced a legal framework that would strike down the minimum wage, that would strike down the ban on whites-only lunch counters, that would strike down federal child labor laws, you know, that would make basically like the entire regulatory state that emerged in the New Deal and thereafter unconstitutional. And so, you know, Ginni Thomas wanted to steal one election. Clarence Thomas wants to make elections irrelevant, because under Thomas's framework, it doesn't matter who wins.
Right.
Because liberals can't pass laws under Clarence Thomas's framework. And so, like, I mean, I think that this is bad, but I think that the opinions that Justice Thomas has been writing out in the open for, you know, more than 30 years are much more scandalous than anything that Ginni Thomas said in a text to Mark Meadows.
Good point. Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent with Vox, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
We're live, Judy. Oh, yeah.
Who am I?
Judy Gold?
Every Jew in Florida. Over the age of 60. Oh, God. Look at this.
You want to shift me over a little bit? Ladies and gentlemen, joining us now on the eve of her huge show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Huge. Yes, from a freshman dorm at University of Miami.
She is now in the comic housing at the University of Miami.
Okay, first of all, I go to an Ivy League dorm, okay?
Well, it's Florida. What I mean?
I mean, University of Miami is an excellent school. But, you know, I'm right now I'm at Stanford, and I'm flying in for the University. Oh, no, Stanford isn't even Ivy League. I'm at, Harvard. Okay. And- So can we just tell the audience why we're talking about this?
I was rude.
Wait. Yes.
When you came on, my first response was not even, hello, Judy. It was, why are you in a dorm room? And I apologize for that.
Okay. That gets a laugh the second time? I don't get it. Listen, Matt, shut up. So here's what happened, ladies, gentlemen, they, thems. This room was my kid's room. I have now, it is transforming into my office. So I'm sitting at a desk. I just bought this sofa that turns into a queen size bed. I haven't put up photos yet. That's the old TV on the dresser. Yes, perhaps it resembles a dorm room. Okay. But it is not a dorm room.
Very well. All right.
Thank you.
I apologize. I am sorry.
Yes.
Well, I want to see what's behind you instead of the majority report. Like, what's the real thing behind? Is that a green screen?
Lots of
papers strewn right all over the place. And
okay.
The dorm room.
There you go.
The dorm room.
Hurry up, Jimmy Thomas.
Ladies and gentlemen, Judy Gold is here. She is tomorrow. Well, let's do the plug up front.
Okay,
and
plug
then,
it.
We'll do it. We'll bookend it with the plug. You're going to be in Fort Lauderdale tomorrow?
Yes, at the Savor Theater. The Savor Theater. Well. Yes. I think it's an old movie theater. And then I'm at Governor's. Tomorrow the 26th. I'm at the Savor Theater. And then I'm going to Governor's soon at the April 9th. You know, I do the comedy.
I've heard that. In fact, I also heard that you have a theme song.
Yes, I do.
Judy.
Level-headed.
Fuck you!
Calm, cool, and collected.
I have a bigger penis than him.
Judy Gold is on the line to keep us all connected.
What the fuck is the matter with him?
A steady hand to guide us. She'll keep us calm and carry on.
No fucking way!
Too bad Jimmy Reefer Cook didn't find it worthy of a song with Judy Gold.
And he's such a fucking penis head liar. I'm not kidding. That's the president
so
of the United States. That's the president. What the fuck?
Okay.
Like this guy,
okay, there you go, ladies and gentlemen.
So I love the fadeaway. The fadeaway.
Demonetization for the day. Yes. And there we go.
Yes.
So that means you have
it's so catchy.
Nothing to lose. Judy, so go off.
Yes, all I want to say is there's so many people I could be that infuriated with at this point. Like, I hate Orange Fuckface so much, and I can't believe Alvin Bragg. And so we have that situation. Mitch McConnell is a fucking piece of shit racist. Ted Cruz, his dick is like... He doesn't have a fucking dick. He's a disgusting piece of shit. Tom Cotton should shove it up his fucking ass. Jimmy Thomas, fuck you, you fucking duplicitous piece of shit. I hate all these fucking, I just cannot believe. Ron DeSantis, you fucking asshole. Gay. Like, there are so many abhorrent fucking assholes. To watch Ketanji sit there and have to deal with those I wanted to run in that room. I think any comic would have wanted to shut the fuck up. You fucking, talking over her. He's such a, you know what? All these people, their fucking kids hate their fucking guts and it's going to come out soon.
There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, we know Ted Cruz's daughter hates him.
Ted Cruz.
There's video evidence.
Right.
God, horrible.
And Lindsey Graham, you fucking asshole. And I think pornography on the computer. What's on your fucking computer? fucking closet, you big queen. Don't talk about other people's families when all you're a single, white, entitled, closeted gay man. And you're talking about, you should be proud of your family. What about your fucking family? What's your family? Grindr? Is that your fucking family? You fuck.
Judy, let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
Can you define the word woman, please?
Well, actually, what are you asking me? What are you asking me?
Can't define the word woman. Oh my God.
I can't. Yeah. Someone who hates your fucking guts and thinks you're a piece of shit. That's what a woman is. You fucking white entitled prick.
Speaking of which, yes. We have a video here of Steven Crowder.
Oh, yes.
What do you think about him, Judy?
It's great. He's great. I love him.
Did you ever run into him on the comedy circuit?
No. Have you?
Never did.
He's so hilarious. He's taking all the gigs away from all the great comics.
I mean, you know, when you're my age, you can at least sort of like play it off. Like, yeah, no, I was a comedian. But like,
right.
This dude's like in his 30s, been doing a show. Like, when was he a comedian? When he was like right. Four?
I love that people say that. I love when people say I was a comedian. And me, I've been doing this since the early 80s, have no fucking clue who you are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a voiceover for Arthur characters is a child right, right. Count. Right. But maybe it counts for him.
Even though I did love Arthur with the kid.
Me too.
I enjoyed it. You know, it's a very quality programming.
It's Albert.
Okay, go ahead.
Judy, here is a clip of Steven Crowder.
Yeah, I love him.
It really is, the Republicans and the conservatives, I think, sort of had... they were all playing the same tune, but in a different note. And the YouTubers really, really were playing sort of like, I guess, I don't know, what would you call this? The bass? What's the truest, most purest of the notes?
Is it the melody?
I don't know. I'm not musically inclined.
Well, I think it's the key that it's in is the truest.
Okay, right, exactly. Yes, the key. Yes. And this is the key that sets the tone for just mm-hmm. about all of them. Here is Steven Crowder just yesterday talking about Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination and her credentials.
Wow.
It's just like affirmative action. Let's say that Ketanji Brown, Miss Jackson. Let's say that this person becomes, because I don't want to say, man or woman, because she can't define it, so I wouldn't want a dead name.
No.
Oh, you're so funny.
Becomes a Supreme Court justice. It's like affirmative action. She can never know if it's because she was qualified. That's the issue here. You rob people of their win. She can never know if she was the right person for the job because former Vice President Joe Biden said it will be a black woman.
Oh, my God. You're so fucking smart. Wow.
Good portion of the pool of talent.
Are you saying there was nobody else qualified? How about you just go with qualified? And if it turns out to be her, I am all for it.
Well, the problem is if you're qualified, they accuse you of being a gang rapist.
Well, that's true.
What is this? But it wouldn't.
Oh, yeah. He was really qualified.
Remember him with Kavanaugh?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Just the grandstanding.
He just made that all about. He just said he did a little five-man.
Oh,
you know,
that's your boy. Wait a second. Nick DiPaolo's on there. Look.
Oh, that's Nick DiPaolo.
Now.
I know. You didn't see Nick DiPaolo. He has become Righty Reiterman from Wrightsville.
No, I know it. But let's just talk about, before we get into Nick, and maybe we can listen to what Nick has to say about this. Now, let's just talk about whether Ketanji Brown Jackson can know whether she was deserving or qualified to sit on the Supreme Court. Let me just, like... And she, I imagine, has access to Wikipedia, as does Crowder.
Yes.
She went to Harvard undergrad. She went to Harvard Law. She had three clerkships.
Not qualified.
With a Supreme Court Justice, Stephen Breyer. The number of people who have ever clerked for a Supreme Court Justice,
I imagine it's probably in the, you know, the hundreds, maybe could be low thousands in the entire country, in the history of the court.
History,
yes. History of the court, in the 200 years that we've had this. Three clerkships, Supreme Court, district judge, and a third judge. I mean, it doesn't matter, really. And she served, she was in corporate law, she had like a big law firm, a couple, 2 or 3 years over the course of it. Sentencing. I mean, she's been a judge for over a decade at this point.
As opposed to Amy Coney Barrett, who was a judge for 0.5 seconds before. Oh, I'm
Amy Coney Barrett. By the way, Amy Coney went to
very hard to pronounce her name, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's very hard. A lot of people don't say it correctly on television.
That you gotta call her Miss Coney. Miss Coney.
Yes, Miss Coney Barrett. But she, you know, she takes her husband's name because that's what you do if you're a woman. She knows what a woman is. Amy Coney.
I mean, that's, yeah. The competence part or the qualified part is very interesting coming from a party, supporters of a party that like Trump just appointed like a whole score of Breitbart huffing judges himself.
Right. Yes.
But and the idea that she can't possibly know whether she's qualified is unfair to her. And I wonder, right, what's also amazing to me is,
yeah,
I wonder if this has been a plague for white guys on the court.
So hard.
The decades and actually centuries where essentially you were not eligible to be on the court unless you were white gay because you weren't even allowed to go to law school.
Legacy admissions.
Okay. Can I just add something to that? And very nice, Sam. Very nice. And I love the ire. Listen, here's the deal. Here's the fucking deal. The Supreme Court should resemble the demographics of this fantastic country that we live in. The fact that there's never been a black woman, she went to public school, her parents are public servants, she's a public servant, fucking Kavanaugh sitting there crying about his fucking friend, drunk in the fuck. There is no comparison between Ketanji Brown Jackson. Perfect. She's perfect. She studied improv. She is a well-rounded.
Oh, that's a knock against her.
It is. She has more class. I mean, the fact that she had to sit there and listen to that fucking and John Kennedy. Fuck that. Fuck. I hate that fucker.
Let's listen to a little bit more. I want to hear what Nick DiPaolo has to say because we,
yes,
the three of us have a connection, Judy. Yes. I don't know if you knew.
I love Nick. I love Nick, but I he's turned into like, I don't know what happened to him. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Just the grandstanding. He just made that all about, he just said he did a little five-man, you know, one-act show, one-man play
yes.
for himself. Yeah. She yes. was even getting irritated. Hey, yeah. This is my moment, bitch.
Yes, exactly.
That's the look she had on her face.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
such a. Oh, he's a tool, man.
He never misses an opportunity to grandstand, and he screwed up Newark so bad that he decided to go to Congress.
Right? Yes.
I don't understand. He robbed that city of millions and millions and millions of dollars in funding for education, just completely wasted it on corporate people coming in and advising from New York, ransacked the city, and then's like, I think I'll run for Congress. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Gerald, the correct term is jacked. He jacked the city.
The city, yes. Yes.
Okay. Mm. Well, I mean, they were like approaching some sort of coherent point, maybe criticizing Cory Booker, and then he has to make some Crowder's only contribution is some racist comment.
So Cory Booker spends his time talking about the time that he's allotted, how this nomination, what this nomination means to him and people of color. All over the world, and they spend their time asking her what to define a woman and talk about child porn, but not bring up Matt Gaetz or anyone like that, all their fucking friends, or Jeffrey Epstein or whatever, whoever. So
Jenny Haskert,
yeah, oh yeah, and Jim Jordan, you're fucking
Jim Jordan,
yeah. So they that's not grandstanding. That's not grandstanding. But Cory Booker taking this time to. Whether or not you like Cory Booker to talk about what an important moment this is That's so different. And all these other people are so fucking great, aren't they? They took their time. They really did their research. Chuck Grassley, what the fuck is that? First of all, did you notice they'll ask her a question that they know she can't answer? And like, they'll be like, this is exactly what they do. You're disgusting, Emma. So you're saying that you want more criminals out on the street. Is that what you're saying? And then she says, thank you, Senator. And he's just like this. Not even listening to the fucking answer. She's talking and he's like, okay, let's move on.
Let's talk because more
all
about
I want to do is jerk off here, yeah. But I fucking hate them.
Let's talk about Nick DiPaolo. Nick was on you and I think met when I cast you in B Cops.
Yes, I love that. Do we have a video of that ever?
Of course I have a video of it. So I have a video of it.
Did you play a cop?
Maybe.
No. UPS driver.
Yep. Julie doesn't remember.
I looked hot. I did. Yes, I looked hot in my brown uniform. Yes, I do. I remember we were outside.
Nick DiPaolo played a cop.
Yeah. That,
which I don't think you guys were not in the same scene together. But This was in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking with Nick and he had just moved back to New York. And this is what he said to me. He goes, and I had literally just, I had come from doing a bunch of sitcoms. I had done three or four different pilots with a Nick DiPaolo type, a guy who's supposedly from like a very Italian. This is back when ethnic was like, if you're Italian or if you're
right.
And so I had done with characters like Nick, like I had a list of like four other people to call for his part, but he was like big. So I wanted someone like that. And he says to me, I said, so you're moving back to New York? And he goes, yeah, you can't get a job out in LA if you're a white guy.
What year was this? 1999.
I was like, are you kidding me? They can't find enough white comedians to front a show right now. Are you serious?
Tim Allen, Jeff Foxworthy, Ray Romano, Jerry Seinfeld.
Those are the ones just that hit. There was so many. They were just cranking them out.
So many white men with so many very attractive wives.
Yes.
Right, Kevin James. Hi, I weigh 700 pounds, but look at my wife.
That's what they said about the Jim Belushi show, too, actually. Yeah. Huh? The Jim Belushi show, they said that. Courtney Thorne Smith.
Right.
I'm not going to tell you what the writers called the scene where Jim Belushi climbed into bed with Courtney Thorne Smith. Even the writers were excited.
Right.
So Nick has come, really, has made it big.
He's really evolved. He's not angry, which is good. He has so much to be angry about. You know,
we have a clip of Steven Crowder doing stand up.
Oh, I can't wait.
RiaCon Midwest.
Sorry, that's T-Con.
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 What is T-Con? Oh, is that that's
like party. Tea
party? Okay.
Convention. So, oh God, so I can't wait.
This is a great gig. Let's check this out.
If you're ugly, you take the Greyhound bus. So I drove here. Notice a really disturbing trend in cars nowadays. I don't know if you folks have seen these dream catchers. Is this thing working? Okay, thank you, sir. Thanks for, you got my back. Appreciate it, Mr. Corpsman. Hurry, car. Oh, God, I'm called the same in Austrian. Notice a disturbing trend. Dream catchers hanging from rear view mirrors in cars. You guys seen this? It's a Native American Indian contraption. Consists of wooden hoops and feathers. Supposed to help you sleep soundly. What the heck would you need a dream catcher in your car? I mean, it's one thing to fall asleep at the wheel, but to plan on it? That's selfish. Not to mention, I don't care if you do have a dream catcher in your car, okay? If you fall asleep at the wheel with over 800 pounds of steel glass and gasoline behind you, it's going to be a bad dream. No one wakes up from that flesh. Of course, I did grow up in Canada. Thanks.
Okay. I think we get a good...
Okay, can I... Wait, first of all, when you're a comic, and you have to ask if the mic is on when it's on, that's a sign right there. That, I can't believe, what a premise. What a fucking premise. That is deep. That is so deep. Oh,
that's
my God.
Getting to the truth back then.
Something just happened, guys.
What happened? We just lost Emma's camera.
That's fine. I see
Emma. No.
There she is. Matt, what
Why
the fuck?
Why was that fine, Judy?
What?
Why was it fine?
It was a joke.
No,
you know what? You should get a dream catcher on your rearview mirror.
All right.
That is the worst. Like, if you auditioned to be a regular at a club with that joke, they'd be like, listen, come back in 5-10 years.
Okay? Your delivery's pretty good, but you're going to need some material, bud.
Right. So what is your persona? You're just a white guy who notices shit in other people's car?
It's observational.
Yeah. Wow, that's a really good observation. That's really deep.
Yeah, we can all relate to that.
What's the deal with the dream catchers?
Can you believe it? You know, I was driving on the highway, and there were people, and they had bumper stickers. And I was like, what if it rains?
Well, I tried to drive up to read the bumper sticker, and then I banged into the car.
And that's 8,000 pounds of car behind the bumper sticker in front of the bumper sticker.
That was a weird part. Like, he all of a sudden works for Car and Driver magazine or something. Like, why is he talking like that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because he has nothing to say. There's nothing for him to say. Like, the only thing he got a reaction on was, I'm from Canada, no one gave a shit. And he goes, oh, thanks. That was the only fucking, yeah.
Yeah, Matt says a little later in the set that there's a lot more racial stuff, which is, should
oh,
not
is that
shock
right?
anybody.
Is that,
oh, really? Oh,
let's get to the stuff that was going to. I mean, to be fair, at this point, he was working for Fox, I think, in 2011. I remember in, I think it was 2011. Was it 2011 or 2010? You know, 2011. In Wisconsin, there were massive protests against Scott Walker's cutting of attacking unions and cutting health care. And if I remember correctly, Crowder showed up and there was a lot of union guys there, and both public and private sector unions. And Crowder was there and some union guy just decked him.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, which I think was very tough for Crowder because you can see he spends a lot of time jacking himself up.
Right.
And, you know, even back then he was obviously spending a lot of time in the gym, and one would imagine that would have, you know, intimidated. And I think, I mean, why else will you do that? Why else do you like bulk yourself?
Well, we know
up
he's
like,
not spending a lot of time reading. Or, you
he
know,
got leveled. He got leveled. And,
this video,
but here is, let's hear his A. This is his A game. This is the stuff he brings out when he's really like needs to get the crowd juiced at a tea party event.
I can't wait.
Now I live in New York. Sorry. Thank you, sir. Now I live in New York City. One day decided I was going to go to New York, maybe as a comic. I think, but the, microphone in my hand, apparently. But, I said, I'm going to go to New York. Maybe it's a comic with a shirt on my back, 3 clean pairs of underwear. 2, actually, after I went through Spanish Harlem. I bumped into a guy there. He got mad. He's like, oh, hey, man.
Who do you think you are? Okay. Oh, I know your kind. I know how your people treat my people.
I'm like, whoa, man, I am from Canada. We don't even have your people. Okay.
There you go.
I'm going to make up a fictional character.
A thing that never happened.
Who, I mean, who's I like,
it's also, he can do the voice. It's all working backwards from the voice.
I watched Scarface 100 times when I was a kid. I really want to deploy this.
I'm shitting my pants because I'm scared because I'm shitting my pants.
Yeah, like the joke is that you're such a little, all right, we've already broken the meter, pussy, that you can't walk through an area without shitting your pants if you see somebody else.
Are there really no people who speak Spanish in Canada?
Yeah, I don't think
is that right? That is weird. Accurate.
Nobody.
I've lived here for like 12 years or so, like, demographically kind of look like a Crowder type and white guy. I've never had that experience where someone says, you people,
just my people. What people? What, like,
this is just like Crowder's. Remember he had that lie in Montreal where he said like he was jumped by an African man?
Yes, when he was scalping tickets.
He fantasizes
something
about this stuff all the time.
Yes.
Maybe he just likes to take poops in his pants.
Yeah. He wants to be relevant and there's nothing about him. He is like, there's nothing evolved about him. He is a white, dumb, fucking, not funny asshole. Take care.
It really is amazing.
He does what Jesse Smollett does.
Yeah. Stories has he been like, you know, for a guy who is that big, too, right? Like, he really gets accosted a lot for some reason.
Everywhere. Every urban environment he's in.
It's so strange.
I mean, at least we know DePaulo's funny. Like, he's worked the clubs. He's like, you know, he's a comedian. This guy is...
He's got all the race of the does, but none of the comedic charm.
Yeah, no substance. No substance whatsoever.
And that was in the first, whatever, few minutes, 4 minutes, two comments about the mic. Is it on? Oh, look at it in
my
hand.
I know, because no one's laughing because you suck.
All right. So like I said, the conservatives on YouTube singing the same song as the Republican senators, but in a key that is more discernible for the naked ear.
Right.
And here is Charlie Kirk really laying out more or less the same thing, right? Like, you have Crowder saying, like, poor Ketanji Brown Jackson, she's not going to know if she's really qualified because, you know,
so deep.
To get on so the Supreme deep. Court because.
Kind of like, right, kind of like everything you do, like when you walk in to a store and you realize, oh, I'm getting treated like this because I'm a white fucking male. You know? Go ahead.
Here is Charlie Kirk following this thread just a little bit more.
So as we get into that, these very simply stated questions do not require overthinking. So I suppose another question here, though, is where does this come from? Well, KBJ, Ketanji Brown Jackson, is what your country looks like on critical race theory. KBJ is your country on CRT. KBJ, Ketanji Brown Jackson, is an embodiment of the tyranny that we currently live under. She's an ideological, unintelligent, yet confident fanatic who is so dismissive that you might even ask the question of what a woman is. And so when she's not even able to answer simple questions on biological reality or the natural law that anchors the Constitution, then how can she possibly be prepared to defend it or the purpose of the Constitution? The answers from KBJ, outside of the fact that she won't answer the very simple ones, such as what is a woman, reveal a distaste for our structure.
He wrote this down.
How will KBJ ever decide a case on a woman's right to choose? How will KBJ ever decide a case on affirmative action if she can't tell us what a woman actually is?
Oh, yeah. I mean, wow.
Black woman on the Supreme Court.
Right.
Yet she won't even admit that she's a woman.
Right. Oh, my God. This makes so much sense. Right.
What, did she not? Was the question about her identification? Because I'm pretty sure she identifies as a woman.
Well, I think Charlie Kirk identifies as an asshole. And I hope, you know, he can talk about how she's not qualified. I mean, because she, what did she do? She went to Harvard and Harvard, and you went to, oh, let's see, where did you go to school? Oh, you went to community college. Oh, my God.
But that's not even the point. It is.
I know it doesn't matter.
This is your country on people who study.
No, on critical race theory.
On race, yeah. People who study, you know, questions of race in this country. That's basically what he's saying. This is what we're living under. This regime where a black woman could actually be on the Supreme Court. How oppressive it is. How oppressive.
And, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Well, sorry. I mean,
I know it's your show.
This is the no, but I'm sorry, but this is like, it doesn't get more naked than this.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
right.
How dare she not answer these questions? Every Supreme Court justice gets up there and right. Doesn't answer questions. It's usually the complaint is they're not answering questions that are relevant to them being Supreme Court justices. In this instance, it's they're not answering questions that are completely irrelevant to their being Supreme right. Court justices.
Right.
It's pretty, you know, they got it down the line. The consistency, it's just like they just say it in slightly different ways.
Right. They just say it's the same key. And, you know, critical. Let's just take the word critical. Analytical. Analytical is the same as critical. That would mean you would have to actually delve into something, learn about it, gather information, see things from different points of view. That's what that would be. That is impossible for them. They grab one little thing and that's all they can fucking hang on to. And it's bullshit. And you're dumb. You're fucking dumb. And you sound like an idiot.
I mean, the quote, I just looked it up to make sure this is the case. Ketanji Brown Jackson, quote, is what your country looks like on critical race theory. So like, this is the blackening of your country.
Yep.
Look at her. She's going to be in a position of power. More critical race theory. Just delete and copy and paste blackness into
no one blackness. Yeah,
right. That's what it is. More non-white people in this country, more non-white people in positions of power, be very, very, very anxious about that. That's what this is.
Right.
And then, you know,
they have been doing, the white men have been doing such a wonderful job.
Wonderful.
It really did. Ah, what a great job you've done. You fucking entitled pricks.
Have you noticed what's going on the road when you go out and do your shows? You're starting to do shows now, right? You've been doing it for a while. What's the mood? Give us the sense of what's happening in the
country. Well, you know, now, you know, if I go do a show, the people are coming to see me. So they kind of know what they're getting. So I, you know, there is a bit of, when I'm in the clubs in the city, there's a bit of this. You say something hilarious. And then the audience is like,
oh, right. Not supposed to laugh at that.
Like they can't think behind the trigger word. Everything is about them. You know, it used to be like you did a joke and then it was over. You know, you did the joke. You didn't like the joke. Move on. But now it's like this whole, you know, we're just comedians. Until we say something you don't like. And it's ridiculous. But, you know, my audience comes to see me and I'm lucky for that. But it's like, it's ridiculous. Shut up. Oh, God, it's Ginny. Ginny's on her way. We're having lunch together.
Oh.
Ginny's. We're having Thomas's English muffins. Ginny.
You're really excited about the Ginny's thing.
Oh my God, she's so fun, Ginny.
She says crazy stuff.
Yeah, she texted me like so many times. It's so
what a wild card.
You should invite her to your show,
Ginny Thomas.
You really thought about that, like inviting luminaries like this to your show.
That's a good idea.
That would be pretty fun, I think.
Girl power.
All right, I'll do that. I mean, she's really she seems like a lot of fun.
It's very possible. You don't know.
Yeah.
That would be quite an odd couple, you two.
Is he going to recuse himself?
No.
Do we even know if he's in?
He's out of the hospital today.
No, he just got out of the hospital.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
That sucks.
Sorry, everybody.
Sorry. Yeah, and then right. That's, you know, for you to say that's horrible. He wants it to be in the hospital.
How right. could you possibly say that?
Right.
Yeah, that's, I'm not too worried about that. I feel very confident that it is perfectly appropriate to wish ill upon, well, it's not so much I wish ill. I just wish that certain Supreme Court justices would no longer be on the Supreme Court. And so.
Agreed.
No, we're just saying, I was saying, I am rooting for him to get a vacation home on a beach and to stay there for the rest of his life.
Right.
I'm willing to concede that I am okay with him feeling like, oh, this illness has given me a new sense of how fleeting life is. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I'm going to retire and get on with, you know, the next chapter of my life.
Yeah, just enjoy my retirement with my wife.
Yeah, why am I doing this?
I mean, they are a match made in hell, but they seem to love each other. Spend time together. Do it.
Yeah.
Need to spend more time with your
wife. Yeah, I think it's all about family. That's Lindsey Graham. He knows about family.
Also, you know, he could maybe, you know, do more out of office than he could do in office.
Right.
We hear that occasionally.
Outside change theory.
Right.
Exactly.
Huh?
Oh God!
The world needs a Clarence Thomas podcast.
Oh, I would love that. That would be hilarious.
That's how he can really change the world.
Speaking of which, Judy, what's happening on your podcast these days?
Well, I have some lovely this week. I have Malcolm Nance, who was amazing. We learned all about his life and growing up, and then. I got to tell you,
I'm a little bit skeptical of Malcolm.
Really?
I got to tell you.
Why?
I had him on years ago to talk about his book on Islam. And in the course of that conversation, he had made a statement about Anwar al-Awlaki's son.
Who's Malcolm who?
Malcolm Nance.
Okay.
And, right? This is the guy from, this is like the terror expert, right?
Yeah, he's a cryptologist, terror, yeah.
And he had said that Anwar al-Awlaki's son, who was the American that the Obama administration assassinated, his son, who was also subsequently killed by a drone attack, mm-hmm. was supposedly holding a weapon when he died. The kid was young, mm-hmm. was out looking for his father, and was... Every other report I heard was that he was at a table eating or something. And mm-hmm. no one, not even the administration, ever made the claim that he had a gun. Mm-hmm. Malcolm claimed that he did. I asked him about that a couple of times. And then I subsequently asked, you know, some other people. I think it was Jeremy Scahill came on the show. And I asked him on air. I said, did you ever hear anything about that at all? And... He said no. And then I ran into Malcolm at in the MSNBC green room or one place. And I was like, do you have a link for that? Like, where can I find that report anywhere? He's like, well, I'm not a journalist. I'm a spy. And I'm like, but do you have anything to back that up? Cause you weren't on an op when you came on my show. You were speaking as a guy who had written something. He's like, I don't have it. And then he wanted to know if I was going to have him on his show, on my show again. And I'm like, I can't do that. If I can't substantiate what you're saying and I just have to trust you because you're a spy, it doesn't make any sense to me. But that was it. Other than that, he seems like a nice guy, though.
He's such a nice guy. Well, we talked about his family and how he became a military guy and everything. It was really interesting.
I bet his story is interesting.
Fascinating.
What else? Who else do you have on that I can?
I had Sharon Glass on because she
Sharon Glass. Book. Oh my God! You have no
I love
idea.
Her.
I'm joking. I don't know
what.
Who's that?
Oh my God! She was on Cagney and Lacey, but she wrote this book. Her life is fucking fascinating.
Was she on Cagney or Lacey?
Yes, she was Lacey.
Oh yes, I'm a fan.
Oh no, she was Cagney.
It doesn't matter. Christine I had crushes on both of them as a kid.
Oh my God. But that show was really, yes, right? She wrote a book. Her life is fucking amazing. So we had her on, like it's me and someone else. Okay. I'm actually looking up to see. She was Christine Cagney, I think. Let's see. Drem series. Yeah, she was lead.
Yeah, she was Cagney.
Yes, she was Cagney. I have on this guy, Jared, who is an African American Jew who, played basketball.
Oh, I know that dude. And he's in Israel and they won't let him play or something.
Right. I had him on. He told me the whole story of his family and his Judaism and how he just wants to play basketball and the racism and that. And it's a really interesting story. He's a great kid. And then I have Zorna Garg, who is an Indian comic who grew up in Bombay.
You've got such a wide array of guests on your show.
I know, because I find people fascinating. And they're very long interviews because I really talk about who they are in their childhood. And I do so much research, and people are always like, oh my God, you did read my book. Or, oh my God, you did. How did you find that out? And it's called due diligence, you fucking assholes.
Do you say that to them?
No, I just say I've had so many interviews where, you know, you go to do something and it's like, how'd you start in stand-up? It's like, really? Is it harder for women in stand-up? Shut up. Seriously. So I wanted to be the one that really does the work, and you get to talk about, and people love it. People love that someone actually took the time to find out who they are. And
are people coming into your studio now?
No, I've been doing it via Zoom, but I wanted them to come to the dorm room.
Oh, you would do it in the dorm room?
I would find a studio. But it's like a schleppy schlep with the schlep. And I just interviewed.
No,
I just went to Midwood. Is that in Brooklyn?
Yeah, that's where out. Yeah.
And I interviewed an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor who lived in a shed with her family for 2 years with a bucket in the middle of the floor. Wore the same outfit for 2 years, hidden. It is the most unbelievable story you've ever heard.
Well, I'm going to tune in for it.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I'm not just one thing, Sam. I'm not just a woman. I'm more than a woman. More than a woman.
Yeah. All right. Well, folks can go. Where can they get tickets for the Fort Lauderdale show?
Yeah, go to judygold.com. And it's all there, JUDYGOLD.com. But then my Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok is JEWDYGOLD because I'm a Jew.
Jewry, right.
But yes, tomorrow night, the 26th, I'll be in the Fort Lauderdale. And then April 9th, I'm in Governors on Long Island.
Exciting. Judy Gold, ladies and gentlemen.
I love you guys. Emma, you look fantastic. Sam, you're so hot. I can't even. Are you getting the ladies? You're getting the ladies.
Oh, you know, I'm.
Yeah, he does well, Emma.
Yeah. I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, I know. Matt, thanks for showering. Appreciate it.
Anytime. I always shower before you come on.
Shower.
No, Matt always showers. Oh,
Matt.
Yeah.
Yeah, Matt showers.
Matt, I said, Matt, thanks for showering. I know you. What did he say?
He said he didn't shower.
I had to kind of rush out today.
I know. But you know what's great?
Up too late playing video games, is my bet.
Yeah. Bingo. All right. Nailed well, you was wanting your three pair of underwear, clean underwear.
All right, Judy. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
All right. Good. Jenny's here. I love you. Bye-bye.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, it's another Freebie Friday. This is the second Freebie Friday in a row.
Wow, it's already 1:55.
I know it. Wow. I know it. Let's get into this. No calls today, but we will read some IMs. Kern Connor, please interview Morgan Harper, running for U.S. Senate in Ohio. She's like a Midwestern AOC. Yes, I interviewed her. Oh, you said you interviewed her before. Yes.
She's a great interview, actually. We got to talk about that. We got to get into, you know, how we're going to do, if we're going to interview any candidates. Maybe we'll do like a candidate's day or something like that. Let's do this clip. This week, Madeleine Albright passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And she's getting, of course, when any, you know, like, in, I guess, former government official, and she was well known. And was she a former, like, Secretary of State, right?
First woman Secretary
of State.
Yes, that's right.
And she was, I believe, a refugee herself,
yep.
Right? Matt, you've retweeted something like amazing fire tweet. Then she created a bunch of refugees.
Yeah, the Law Boy said that she experienced the full breadth of the human experience from being a refugee herself to creating a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Important for people to see things like that. I don't even know if this is the worst thing that she ever said publicly, frankly.
This isn't the it was worth it to starve Iraqis.
Right. This is there was
but
one
it's
point
a partner piece.
Yes. At one point she was asked about the embargoes under the Clinton administration of Iraq, and she said it was worth it to
500 million or 500,000 kids
to those kids die of starvation. Here she is. Well, here, I'll let
a college student on the campus asks her this question. Her answer
is just a great question.
Change my mind. Go ahead,
this is the college campuses, baby.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about dictators of countries like Indonesia, who we sell weapons to, yet they are slaughtering people in East Timor? What do you have to say about Israel, who is slaughtering Palestinians, who impose martial law? What do you have to say about that? Those are our allies. Why do we sell weapons to these countries? Why do we support them? Why do we bomb Iraq when it commits similar problems?
That's nice. Cheers.
There are various examples of things that are not right in this world, and the United States is trying... really am surprised that people feel that it is necessary to defend the rights of Saddam Hussein, when what we ought to be thinking about is how to make sure that he does not use weapons of mass destruction.
I'd like to...
shouting, just a moment.
I'm not defending them in the least. What I am saying is that there needs to be consistent application of U.S. foreign policy. We cannot support people who are committing the same violations because they are political allies. That is not acceptable. We cannot violate U.N. resolutions when it is convenient to us. You're not answering my question, Madam Albright.
And this is in 98. That dynamic following 2001 changed dramatically, where if that kid had asked that question of someone like Madeleine Albright in 2002, the booing and cheering and would have been towards that guy. And she would have opened her mouth and they would have been applauding. But this is, it's important to get the people understand, you know, the mentality of these people that we now see the mainstream media, the corporate media, the sort of praise simply because they were there.
Yeah. By the way, that was John Strange. He's a public defender in Pennsylvania now. So just a great example of, I mean, it's funny, like the perception, like everything's new in the left and happened like post Bernie. And it's interesting to know like that how long this stuff has existed, but just unable to be elaborated in media.
Yeah.
Occasionally like filter out at a
and also
town hall like this.
Why people are like, you know, you mentioned Crowder for a second, why there's this fear of this kind of sentiment growing and percolating on college campuses, because this is when young people are getting are starting to think critically about the world, and these ideas can spread and it threatens people in power. And so, yeah, I mean, Madeleine Albright and the George H.W. Bush administration before her, they deserve a lot of condemnation for setting the table for the destruction and devastation that we saw in Iraq during the war. It didn't just happen starting in the early 2000s. It started before that, obviously.
The difference, of course, is that I think in many respects, colleges were that much more important for this type of stuff. Or the existence of colleges were almost like not the sole, but one of the primary vehicles for these ideas to spread, because you had people who were in close quarters and had the ability to sort of communicate and, you know, put up a couple of flyers on a college campus. It's going to get a lot more attention than if I put it in downtown, whatever it is, Boston or something. And
before the internet.
That's my point. Okay, there was no internet. No, yeah. But that's exactly it.
Yeah.
Like, the internet in some ways has diminished the weight that needed to be placed on college networking to get these but like, you know, that was on CNN once. I can assure you it was never played again. Somebody had a recording of it and they ended up putting it on YouTube, but YouTube didn't even exist until 2004, 2005. And so there was no way to sort of communicate to people to get people to be outraged at something like that. And that has been a big, big change. And it's going to be much harder in the future to sort of like, you know, bury these figures, these former heads of state, more or less, and have their records whitewashed.
It's fascinating, though, because that's exactly what I have. CNN's always on in my laundry room, right? So I heard Bill Clinton call in to talk about Madeleine Albright, and I was like, you know, folding my clothes and listening to this. And I mean, it's just relentless propaganda. And it is such a contrast to the way we do our show, but also what you just see online and like the media apparatuses that don't want that, you know, that want to engage in hagiography, they look more and more like dinosaurs every day compared to like the breadth of information that you can find on the internet that contradicts that kind of stuff.
Honestly, back at that, in that era, the only time that you would get any type of like a pushback, you know, was like a Democracy Now. When they once, right. like sort of sandbag.
Amy Goodman, I think, asked Madeleine Albright a really tough question in a similar vein that I saw somewhere in another.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Yeah. And she had Clinton on, and he was enraged after he got up after that, because he thought that like nobody asked me those type of questions. And that's the way it was back then. There was no questioning any of that. Where should we go here?
Three. Putin. Huh? Putin.
What's that? Oh, we hadn't done that yet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Speaking of lunatics, I'm always going to preface it this way. I am not qualified, and I'm not going to pretend that I am qualified to assess how the military campaign is going in Ukraine. But as someone who doesn't know any of this stuff, there's a lot of indications that it's not going the way that they want it. Like, we were talking about a Ukrainian offensive. Maybe that's just a complete myth, but it's weird that they were, I don't think like a month and a half ago, anybody would say like, wait till the Ukrainian offensive with all these 150,000 troops in Russia. I don't think that you would be hearing the sort of the snowflakey, the West is declaring war on us by imposing economic sanctions because we're bombing the hell out of a country. Here is Putin. Seems like this dude has not been getting out enough.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine I'm a soldier on the front lines and I'm looking for a rousing speech from the leader.
Yeah, here comes the leader. I got you.
Didn't begin yesterday. We know this very well. In Hollywood, they avoided films even when they made films where the only winner, the country that defeated fascism, was the United States, and didn't say anything about the Red Army. But if you look at the number of military units fighting in the East, that was the Russian units. So the they just canceled the contribution of the Red Army into the defeats over the Nazis. And in Japan, they don't even mention who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or they just say it was done by some abstract allies. And the fact that it was the United States who did such an awful slaughter at the end of the war, this fact is not even mentioned. So they just canceled cynically this truth. They canceled Joan Rowling recently, the children's author. Her books
from Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
That's my point. That's what the best part is. Is like, you're like, okay, kind of fair, you know.
I mean, I don't really understand the point of we blame allies for dropping the bomb. I feel like we're pretty aware that it was.
Oh, I think his point is well taken insofar as, like, yes, in America, when we recount World War II, we don't give much credit, never mind to the French or the British, but certainly to the Soviet Union, not at all.
I mean, they lost 20 million people, yeah. And there, I think, is in Russia, like, a significant amount of understandable resentment towards the United States for us puffing our chest, like, we're the liberators, we saved and we jumped in at the 11th hour, and, like...
Yeah, better invade Ukraine about it.
And people's grandparents are... Right, exactly.
That's the twisted part, and it's also, like, this is such a grave injustice, I'm going to compare it to what's happening with J.K. Rowling.
I know.
It's like I'm all for like revising our understanding of that as like a massive terror attack, basically. But like J.K. Rowling's your next,
and that's why troops, you have to fight and kill some more Ukrainians just because they keep canceling good heroes like J.K. Rowling.
Go back, and so that we can get the full sort of like pivot here
and the flummoxed translator.
Just in case you're not clear on how much of a slight this is on Russia and how much, like in Japan, they don't hold the U.S. to account, I'm going to remind you by bringing up what's happening to the author of Harry Potter and her transphobia.
The fact that it was the United States who did such an awful slaughter at the end of the war, this fact is not even mentioned. So they just canceled cynically this truth. They canceled Joan Rowling recently, the children's author. Her books are published all over the world, even just because she didn't satisfy the demands of gender rights. They're not trying to cancel our country. I'm talking about the progressive discrimination of everything to do with Russia, this trend that's unfolding in a number of Western states with the full...
Can you pause it for a second? I just really love like this image of Putin isolated on his $100 million super yacht, not seeing anybody during COVID, just cannot stop reading Barry Weiss's Substack.
Yeah, about the J.K. Rowling thing.
Yeah. It's just obsessed with Barry Weiss.
He's sandwiched between these two sort of like, you know, sort of, I guess, it's like significant like sources of you know, I guess, national aggrievement.
Yeah.
That, you know, and like, I think just even having to go for the national aggrievement at this point is indicative that he's a little bit backheeled. But the idea that the thing that bridges these two things of national aggrievement is J.K. Rowling. It's just bizarre.
It's like, we're really upset about the Treaty of Versailles, and also Charlie Chaplin needs to be in more movie theaters.
Yes! I mean, this is like Ginny Thomas level of like, sort of just like, dude, you gotta... It feels like he's about to link to his Substack.
They call her a TERF.
Alright, so go back a little bit so that people can just sort of appreciate again. He's going from they don't hold the U.S. to account for dropping the atomic bomb and killing so many people in such a horrible way. They don't get held to account for completely negating our role in defeating fascism in this world. And they're also got some issues with a writer about her gender. And then he goes into the next one.
I hope he mentions the Cho Chang thing.
Well, even just because she didn't satisfy the demands of gender rights, they're not trying to cancel our country. I'm talking about the progressive discrimination of everything to do with Russia, this trend that's unfolding in a number of Western states with the full neglect or sometimes encouragement of Western cultures, that they're now engaging in the cancel culture. They're even removing Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich, Rachmaninoff from posters. Russian writers and their books are canceled. There's now the latest program to cancel world literature was conducted by the Nazis in Germany 90 years ago. We remember those that footage when they were burning books. It's impossible to imagine such a thing in our country, and we're insured against this thanks to our culture, and it's inseparable for us from our motherland, from Russia, where there is no place for ethnic intolerance, where for centuries representatives from dozens of ethnic groups have been living together, and cultural diversity is the pride of our society, the strength and priority of our state.
I mean, the only thing I can think is that he wants to obscure the reasons why these things are happening around the world. Now, I personally think, whether you're removing Russian literature or even like Russian vodka, unless you can trace it back to somebody who's providing some type of material support for the country. I mean, most of this stuff is already in country, and things like, we're not going to allow this Russian violinist to play with our opera. I think that's just absurd. But I think from his perspective, maybe he brings up the J.K. Rowling to make it seem like that's all this is about.
Yeah, he wants to go on Joe Rogan.
Literally does.
It's been horrible since this invasion started, and I haven't seen a single Tchaikovsky or Rachmaninoff poster up because we had to take them all down immediately.
Yes.
The house elves likes their slavery.
Like, yeah, that stuff is dumb. That sort of anti-Russian thing where we're not going to let a Russian blue cat, as somebody who owns a Russian blue, compete in cat festivals or whatever, that's dumb. But like, also, there's a lot of anti-American sentiment during the Iraq invasion of Iraq, and I think like it shouldn't have been aimed at normal or everyday Americans, but it frankly is understandable.
Well, and it's frankly, let's be honest, if you hold the belief that Putin is an authoritarian, and that is a very authoritarian state, it makes more sense, and that the United States is not. It makes more sense to hold Americans to account for the actions of their government more so than one would for Russia. I mean, that's just common sense. But it could be his strategy to sort of basically communicate to his, to the Russian people. The reason why this is happening has nothing to do with the bombing that we're doing, has nothing to do with killing women and children and invading a country on the premise of like a potential threat that doesn't seem to be forming. Maybe the reason why we're getting canceled is just because they're all, the harping liberal snowflakes who they're the authoritarians.
Well, it shows he's monitoring how the United States right is positioning themselves. I mean, like, there's
probably too closely.
They're trying to take pages out of the other's book.
Yeah, worry about your troop positions more than how their rights.
But I think
that's why he's
on
Barry Weiss's Substack all the time.
I think the more like the domestic, morale, I should say, of the people there, this could be a function of that as much as it is, people on the front. It could be just more of a function of like, the reason why we're getting sanctions and whatnot is a function of, ask Tucker Carlson. Yeah. He'll tell you, here, play this clip of Tucker Carlson, which is literally what they're doing.
Yeah, they're doing so much. America's doing so much cancel culture to us that we have to pull off a whole bunch of stations off the airwaves and shut down publications.
But we got to do that because of all the cancel culture in America.
It'll have the same effect on the right here. They'll still try to do the same stuff.
But of course, who knows if anybody will see that in Russia, because they're probably shadow banning.
Oh, totally.
Putin right now.
Putin, go on Rumble.
Oh, let's play this Ron Johnson clip, shall we?
This guy's... from, this is the one from yesterday, Bradley? Yeah, great.
Ron Johnson, arguably one of the stupidest people ever to be in the Senate. Probably not arguably the stupidest person in the Senate, but...
Nah, Tuberville.
Ah, shoot, that's right. He probably lost the title.
I mean, Tuberville, he's winning SEC championships down there with the dumbest senator.
but...
Being a college football coach is not hard.
He Johnson had the title, lost it when Tuberville came in. But do not let Ron Johnson's stupidity in any way distract you from just what a horrible, horrible, elite, wealthy a-hole he is.
This is out of control. The problem is, Dan, is the American public likes benefits. They love checks, okay? And until you break them of that habit, because they're always promised, by the way, we're going to give you money and we're going to make somebody else pay for it. Well, in the end, people have to realize the money's in the middle class.
Break them off of that habit.
Ron Johnson just, has a sense of why people like getting stuff. This dude, if I remember correctly, was a chief executive officer of a polyester and plastics manufacturer. Ooh, founded by his brother-in-law. That's weird.
It's very middle class.
Hmm. My brother-in-law, I got this job by marrying into it.
I mean, that's how the founding fathers' fortunes were basically made. Like Washington's ancestor, you would marry a widow who had the property in Virginia still because her husband died of some sort of disease. And that's how you come up really fast.
That's entrepreneurship in and of itself, though, right? You got to find the right widow.
Well, a lot of networking is really important. Networking, very, very important to success.
Keep grinding. But that's how the entire Republican and many Democrats view public benefits. You can't give them a taste because they're just going to ask for more. That's why Nancy Pelosi did not temporarily expand. What'd you say, Bradley? Oh, yeah. The spigot, right. Like yep. That's why Nancy Pelosi, they went through the whole, that effort to essentially, damn, I lost my train of thought. Medicare during the pandemic.
Cobra instead of expanding Medicare.
Yeah,
because
right.
They didn't want people to get used to having Medicare.
Right. If you
even
open the door a crack.
Effectively, it was on the user end, it was more or less the same in terms of cost for a period of time. Far more expensive for the U.S. government. But exactly. They didn't want people to get used to these benefits. We could pull them away. It's like it's the Joe Manchin school of disciplining your citizenry.
Yeah, and I'd just say, like, when he says the money is in the middle class, like, no, it's not. It's in the ultra-wealthy capitalist class, and that's where we should take it from.
It's the middle class is literally hollowed out.
The middle class was created by those sorts of transfers and benefits.
90% tax rate, I think it was in 1958. For every dollar you made over... At that time, I think it was like $470,000 is off the top of my head, but which is a functional equivalent of $3 million. Every dollar you made in a given year, however you made it, capital gains or wage, every dollar after $3 million, 90 cents went to the U.S. Mm-hmm. government and then redistributed. Governments always redistribute money, regardless. It's just a question of from whom to whom.
And strange how the tax cuts basically since then have led to a smaller middle class, if Johnson says is accurate. Of course, it's not.
Let's go to the IMs, North Dakota Llama. White Power Ranger is my favorite ranger, Sam. I think Biden is doing about as well as he could be expected with dealing with an insane despot like Putin. Mr. President, what's a nuclear war if it makes us look weak to avoid it? Mansai, I love you guys so much. You've been a pivotal in solidifying my views as a leftist. It's been a really incredible time. Emma's the blueprint for the woman I want to be, so it's always great seeing her get really passionate about the items you guys discuss. Thanks so much for everything. By the way, still looking for live streaming tickets for the Boston shows, if those are going to happen. We're looking into that. Not sure if they have the capacity to live stream there. The Bell House, like, did all that stuff during COVID. And don't know if the Wilbur has that, but we're going to look into it, and we will let you know.
And thank you for your kind words.
Between the 101 and the 5, decarbonization is the new word for Sunset Lake CBD. You decarb your flowers, and you can literally sprinkle it on any meal. American Idol has taught us the best way to make foreign policy decisions. Oliver Wendell Holmes, like, Sam, you need to brief your staff on the Geneva Convention's provisions against cringe as a war crime. Yesterday at the kids' table, they featured Deaf Poetry Jam by Barry Weiss, multiple clips by Cory Booker. It's like using napalm on our eardrums. The horror. The horror.
Oh, Felipe. I'm so sorry.
I'm Venezuelan. I grew up in South Florida. I just wanted to say that I'm really appreciated the interview with William Newman. As a leftist myself, it's sometimes hard to reconcile with leftists in the U.S. that defend the Maduro regime and Chavismo without understanding the nuances. I also agree with William that Venezuela is not and has never really been a socialist country. Instead, socialist label has been nothing more than a branding exercise. Corruption runs rampant and freedom of speech is non-existent. Criticize Putin for silencing opposition news outlets and imprisoning journalists. When it comes to Venezuela, people refuse to acknowledge it. Nothing is black and white, and the situation in Venezuela is a perfect example. You can be a leftist while also being critical of the Maduro regime, Chavismo in general. Thank you guys for having William on.
Okay. Thank you for writing in.
Clown Show Mike, I'm coming to the Boston live show and would love to supply your pre-show beers. My brewery is in Boston. Clown Show Mike, you should email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com.
We will certainly flag such an email.
Boston Brewery.
I'll drink it on stage. If that's allowed on the.
I think it is.
The Wilbur.
2 p.m. Help yourself, buddy. Soft collar.
Drinking Sam, is allowed in Boston.
Yeah. Sam Soft Collar. Hi, I'm our crew. I was reading a comment thread on Reddit. Cringe, I know. Band found some complaining about Republicans questioning KBJ over the last week with regard to her religious affiliation. They asserted that this was unconstitutional under what I believe is Article 6 of the Constitution, roughly stating that there shall be no religious test applied as a condition of public office. Would seem Republicans just say that's not conditional. Seems like an instance of them going against their stated core principles or something. I don't know. I think you can ask, not necessarily if there's a religious test, but how, you know, different elements of your life impact your decision-making. I'm not as concerned about that, frankly, but I think Judy's a little cynical about shows. I perceive a dynamic many are going through where people are afraid to laugh too hard at certain jokes in case of offending others around them. On one hand, it's a sign of folks adjusting to be more aware of cultural sensibilities. And on the other hand, grand number of folks that still model the general neo-lib paradigm are usually taking it too far. I don't share a reasoning, but I do share the frustration. It's feeling out of process. Sorry, I'm not a wordsmith. Just wanted to give some optimistic take on that. I don't understand. I know how these things can be weaponized by a neoliberal agenda, but I think it's wrong to confuse the fact that society is going through a reckoning, and it's going to be ongoing, and it has been ongoing, frankly, for the past 40 years, it seems to me. And maybe prior to that, where people are beginning to realize that, like, hey, wait a second, stuff that we perceived before to be just jokes, we wouldn't say that about other people. And, you know, I'm not as concerned with that. Do I think that there is overreach at times? Of course, because that's the way social changes happen.
There's tension.
Exactly. And that's the way it's going to happen. But don't confuse somebody being uptight about something in a comedy club or out, you know, out on the street or, in, you know, at your Thanksgiving table or at a restaurant or wherever it is. Someone responding with like, ooh, I'm not sure I feel comfortable with that. With that being a neoliberal agenda, it is true
that those who want to obscure within our politics certain class dynamics will employ stuff like that. But that doesn't mean that that stuff is illegitimate. It just means that it often is used as a distraction for other things. But you can still feel that that stuff is wrong. I think that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of comics do have this sort of anxiety. It comes up in a lot of stand-up that I've been watching lately. I think certain comics deal with it better than others. I think Dion Cole is someone who dealt with it pretty well. But yeah, like we're not... Audiences aren't the same as they were when they were going to Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's changed a little bit. People are getting a little bit more sophisticated about what they want to laugh at.
Oh, why are you such a beta about saying my name? Oh, I didn't say the name. Is, is Kierdes Mejor.
Left is best. Is Kierdes Mejor.
Is Kierdes Mejor. All right, there you go. I pronounced it, I think, fairly well. Between the 290 and Route 9, Carl Behar and the Left Reckoning proposed offering refugee status to Russian citizens. Could mitigate both the cultural harm done by sanctions and the galvanization of anti-U.S. sentiment in Russia. But I haven't heard anyone pressuring Biden to do it. Yeah, that seems like a smart move. Brain drain. Currently a grad student at Georgia Tech says, not my pope. Home of the Macaulay Aquatic Center from the video earlier in the week. And leaving the gym Wednesday, I noticed another swim meet going on and probably too creepily checked out everyone's shirt to find out one of those nuttos from the video. No luck this time. Also, it's wacky to see someone like Marsha Blackburn stand up for women. She also caters to the people Jordan Klepper corners into saying that women can't be present because of crazy war-starting hormones. Now that you mention it, what's Marsha Blackburn doing in the Senate? Christo, today is my son Teddy's 17th birthday. For the last 2 years, he have been pretty bad for him. So many kids his age. Shofar, oh, absolutely. I know it. This is for all the kids who've been dealing with this stuff. Red State Zach, who were better, New Deal Democrats or Radical Republicans? Well, that's a good question.
What was the question? New Deal Democrats or
Radical Republicans, from the Reconstruction?
I think the Radical Republicans are probably a little bit better than
I think
New Deal
so.
Democrats. New Deal Democrats emerged after a lot of the communists were sort of suppressed in the left, and it delivered good benefits, but probably could have dealt with more Reds, and probably would have been better coming up against the McCarthyite reaction if it hadn't defang that left. But I think those are the two
radical
best.
Republicans were sort of more like self-starters, it seems like.
Yeah, and the radical Republicans ultimately got beat out by the capitalists and the Republican Party. But I think those are the two, as far as movements that made it through the institutions and actually delivered stuff, those are the two best examples.
And let's face it, if Johnson is not Johnson, I mean, even if he's not insane, this country could look very different right now.
Yeah.
Very, very different. Evan Flo. Anytime I see someone bringing up Q, I like to remind them they're getting their info from an anonymous shitposter using a series of forums that are historically used primarily for anime porn, just to try and keep them grounded. Nikki in Japan. Something has been on my mind for a while. Republicans already control the majority of state legislatures. They're taking steps to seize control wherever they can from local level. They are ever allowed to hold 2/3 of the legislatures at once. They will be able to call a constitutional convention. Pretty worried about this will happen in my lifetime. Ratification requires 75%, but not all states have to ratify immediately. I know it. Left of the box. I've tested negative for COVID for 2 days in a row. I still have a cough, but I think I'm over the worst of it. Just in time for the live show in Brooklyn, which I'll be watching from home. I've been isolated from other humans for 2 weeks. Is it weird? I'm not looking forward to being around people again. No.
It's not weird.
Just feel better. Don't worry about that stuff. But glad you'll be watching. Valley Girl, wish I could attend the live show. Anyway, could you please invite Ellie Mistal on the show to talk about the Supreme Court? We did actually today.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, we, yeah.
But it was traveling. Talia from Tampa, not one of my usual points, but the perfect dismantling of the textualist originalist arguments is gun rights. The Second Amendment was written, arms meant muskets and flintlock pistols, but also meant the same weapons a modern standing military would have. So should I be able to own hypersonic missiles, only a flintlock pistol, or somewhere in between? Yes, that's a great point. All right. 10 more of these. Two kids in a trench coat. Not only are we 2 months closer to the November election here in Wisconsin, but our spring election is April 5th, or put it another way, less than 2 weeks. Jesus. It's insane. Fran Farks. Dog, can we get a round of applause for all the Amazon and Starbucks workers filing for union elections? Maybe toss a blast in from the Jewish ram's horn, L'chaim. Here you go. Good job, Amazon and Starbucks workers. Minnesota teachers ended their strike today. Is that right? I believe that's the case as well. Manny from the Bronx. I'm going to the live show tomorrow. It's my birthday weekend. Are you going to buy me a drink, Sam? I mean, if I have a chance to go to the bar, but I have a feeling I'm going to be, you know, basically doing a meet and greet for everybody after the show. Hopefully somebody will bring me alcohol.
Maybe we should do I was thinking about this. Maybe we should, if people want to take photos and stuff, maybe we should do that outside for COVID reasons. Do you think we can do that?
Anybody in line doing that meet and greet is going to be in a mask.
Oh, there is a meet and greet. Okay.
Doing it outside is a good, I mean, my plan is mask, people wearing a mask coming up, pull it down quick.
For a photo.
Yeah. Okay. But outside is a good idea, actually.
There's like a little area if we wanted to. I mean, I don't know. If people want to take a photo, maybe outside is better. I don't know. Without the mask.
We're going to keep those doors open too, I think.
Yeah. It's supposed to be mid-50s, something like that.
Yeah, we'll figure out something to sort of increase the airflow through there.
Good.
Vinny Holiday. Can some states provide protection for women who have illegal abortions in other states, or simply just not comply with the prosecution of or arrest of such person? The problem is that they're going to pass a law that says, you know, if you get an abortion in Massachusetts and you're from Alabama or whatever it is, you can be sued when you get back.
The Fugitive Abortion Act.
Minneapolis Public Schools reached a tentative deal with teachers on Friday, ending the strike that officially ended, Friday is today, March 8th. It started on March 8th. So hopefully that's a good deal. I don't know much about it, but I just heard that. Big City Progressive. Nope, sorry. You should ask Judy where a black light poster and lava lamp is. Big City Progressive. Whoa. What do you think of all the statement of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and Zelensky's recent address to the Israeli Knesset? PFLP said Zelensky is a puppet of American and Western imperialism and acts on behalf of the detriment of the Ukrainian people. That framing the Palestinian people as the aggressor and Israel as the victim is not only impudent,
I saw
but
that
also
quote.
Insult to people's intelligence.
I saw that quote. I think it's a bit of a stretch that this is like what it's being characterized as. And I am sympathetic to his position in trying to appeal to different governments for assistance. So, I mean... Point taken, but I saw people saying, talking about that, and I tried to find the quote, and I didn't think it was as bad as what people are saying, honestly.
I mean, look, there's no doubt that there are aspects of Zelensky that I don't, that politically I disagree with. I don't know enough about Ukrainian society to say whether you'd want to be a leftist there. But I don't care. I mean, we're not doing Zelensky, you know, like music videos here. Like I think,
yeah. Or even with Israel or with China for that matter, if they can step in and play a role to bring this conflict to an end, the sooner the better, whatever Zelensky has to say. I wouldn't co-sign it, but I would understand it and hope that's where it leads to.
I think it is helpful to continue to remind people that we don't react to what's going on with the Palestinian people in the same way that we react with Ukrainians.
We don't react to what's going on with Yemeni people in the same way that we react to what's going on with Ukraine. This government's going to let in 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. Sort of suggests that we have room in this country. And of course we do. But we should begin to extend this to Haitians, to people from Central America, Central Americans. I mean, and I don't have to be a, you know, Zelensky fanboy to say that in a conflict where people are being bombed on the ground, I'm going to be more sympathetic to the people being bombed than the people who are bombing. That's basically it. I go, maybe we should stop giving weapons to the worst people in the world. Well, I mean, I don't know. Who's worse? The Ukrainian government or the Russian government? Like, I mean, are they really, is Zelensky the worst person in the world? Should we just sit by and just allow them to be bombed?
Maybe they're referring to like the Azov Battalion and the, but still, I mean, I'm
saying like, why hasn't he banned any of the far right wing neo-Nazi parties? I would guess it is when you're in a street fight, you pick up the nearest thing for a weapon.
Yeah, probably because they have they're much more embedded in the defense forces of Ukraine.
Why hasn't Biden banned like or gone after neo-Nazi groups more aggressively? I don't know.
I mean, they're being invaded.
Yeah,
I think probably what you do at that moment when you're being invaded is to not ban those people. Although I think they did ban some of them, didn't they?
Who, Ukraine?
Yeah.
Well, they banned like left-wing parties.
No. My understanding of that party, the people were saying was a left-wing party, that socialist party, not. That it was actually a right-wing party. And I saw links. Like, I saw that dude. Who's that guy who wears the, like, cut-off jean jacket and his big socialist, supposedly, on Twitter, sort of more like a – had a Peter Dow trajectory or something?
Hinkle?
I don't know.
No.
All right.
I muted him a long time ago. Yeah. I don't remember his name now, so – But somebody was pushing that, like, Zelensky banned, you know, left-wing groups, and then a bunch of people immediately showed up and said, dude, just use Wikipedia before you just react.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff is, like, it's like it just reminds me of, like, Lincoln, who continued to have elections through the Civil War, also suspended habeas corpus. And, like, I frankly understand, I applaud the former and understand the latter.
Lefty Lucifer, been listening to the show for a few months now and adore the show immensely. Just became a member today. You're welcome. Thank you so much. All right, three more. Smiling friends, Putin sounds like he's been watching too many Trump speeches and they've rubbed off. Sean from Maryland, never made sense to me that the media's primary goal whenever a major political figure dies is to talk about how great they were. Isn't it supposed to be the job of journalists to hold the powerful people accountable and examine their legacy and the impact it had on society as a whole?
Ideally.
Wishful thinking, I guess. Of course, that's they're never in their agenda to actually do their jobs and instead just serve as hype people for elites.
Yeah, and to get information from those elites. So, like, a lot of people's would
beet sweeteners.
Yeah, exactly.
Hard to argue. And the final I am of the week will come from David. Any radical Republican book recommendations? Read Foner's Reconstruction as a start. He may have some good references, I would say, in there. Matt, Bradley, Emma, great job this week. See you folks in Brooklyn tomorrow.
Well.
Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I
I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know? Takes you. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted it.